Hello, freaks. What the fuck is going on, everybody? This episode of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Have you used Audible.com? What are you doing? Are you just sitting in traffic like a fucking savage? Just listening to nothing or making yourself listen to those assholes on the radio? They're not all assholes. Some of them are very nice guys, but I have to say that for the purposes of this commercial. I don't even have to say it. I just did. Audible.com is the best resource for audio entertainment on the internet. They have over 150,000 titles, audiobooks, and they also have this whisper sync thing that you can use with the Kindle Fire HD. It's pretty dope, where you listen to a audiobook and then it syncs up to your Kindle so that you can read like up to a certain point and you get tired and you're like, oh, but I want to finish this book. You can listen to it on the way to work. It's incredible. So you can read it and listen to it. It's a pretty smooth operation. That's a very smart, ingenious invention. And if you go to audible.com/Joe, you'll get one free audiobook and 30 free days of Audible service. And as I said, they have 150,000 titles. They have comedies. They have, what is that? That's that thing that the Homeland guy's doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, how's that go again?
I have no idea.
He's doing like, and the lead guy from Homeland, what is his name?
Brody,
but what is his real name?
Glenn Garers.
Isn't that weird? Like, that guy's pretty famous. No one knows what the fuck
Damian
his name
Lewis.
Is. Damian Lewis?
Yeah.
Hell of an actor. Except he sucks pretending that he's tired. Like, when he runs out, like, when he's pretending to run out of breath, he's terrible at it. Oh, my God.
Joey D is running out of breath.
He's like a black belt in acting and a white belt in pretending to be, like, out of breath.
How would Joey do it?
Joey do, like, Joey's out of breath all the time.
Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan, there's no need to get fucking all uppity with your cardio. Audible.com/Joe. Get yourself a free audiobook and 30 free days of Audible service. We recommend them very highly. They've always been very cool, and they have always supported stand-up comedy as well. There's so many different things to get on, including the Opie and Anthony radio show, and it's an awesome resource. Audible.com/Joe. Go get yourself some free shit, son. We're also brought to you by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is a great way for you to incorporate yourself, for you to start a will. You can even get divorced, okay? You can do it online. It's pretty amazing. You can go to LegalZoom.com and take care of a lot of shit that you used to have to go to an actual lawyer for. You know, it used to cost you a lot of money. That's not necessary anymore. And if you do panic, if you get to a point, you're like, fuck, I'm going to jail, they can connect you with an independent attorney if you need additional guidance. So if you get to a certain point and you're like, this just seems fucked, I'm too stupid for this, you bail. LegalZoom is not a law firm. What they do is they provide self-help services at your specific direction. But it's super easy to do. That's how Onnit was incorporated. Brian's used them to incorporate. You can get a will for $69. You can incorporate. You can form an LLC for just starting at $99. It's beautiful. They can take care of trademarks, copyrights, patents, all that legal shit. If you got a great idea and you want to protect it, LegalZoom can hook it out. So check out LegalZoom.com and use the code name Rogan in the referral box at checkout and save yourself some more money. In the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom, and they've saved an ass load of money. That's what it says on the thing. It says they saved an asshole. That's what the ad says. It's not what it says, Brian. You don't even care. I'm just making things up in this commercial, and you don't even care. LegalZoom.com. Use the code word Rogan. We're also brought to you by Onnit.com. Use the code name Rogan and Onnit also, and save yourself 10% off any and all supplements. We have a lot of shit other than supplements. Onnit is what we like to refer to as a human optimization website. We just sell shit that makes you work better. Makes your body work better, makes your brain function quicker, makes your endurance better, strength and conditioning equipment that provides functional strength that really does translate into athletic improvement. There's a lot of exercises that people do that don't translate really well into sports.
I like how you have, like, they have packs now. They have the caveman pack.
Yeah, we've always had stuff like that.
It's so funny.
Oh, this is the new one. Okay, I haven't seen that. Where is that under?
It's, I don't know. It was under supplements, and they have, like, these packs now.
Who's David Rickles?
David K. Manrickles, who fights in Bellator.
Oh. Okay.
Sweet club.
I get it. Well, it's not a caveman pack. It's really like a fighter that you guys sponsor and you guys are trying to blow him up, right?
Yeah, kinda? Yeah. No, okay. His nickname is Caveman, so that's why it's a caveman pack.
Oh.
Get it?
Yeah, now I get
Dave Rickles, caveman
I pack. Just thought it was like on it. We have a caveman pack. We have a, you know, gladiator pack.
No, his name is Caveman. And since we sponsor him.
A lover pack. You know what I mean? All the Viagra shit you guys use.
That's that Bellator 155-pound weight class is a tricky weight class, man. We'll talk about that on the podcast. This is just the commercial part. Use the code Nate Rogan, save 10% off any and all supplements. We also have Primal Bells, kettlebells with awesome gorilla faces. We got to get you some for 10th Planet.
10th Planet Bells?
Yeah, you don't have. Oh, we have a new monkey, too. We have a new 18-pound monkey.
Look at that little baby.
A little howler monkey. Plus, we got a zombie coming out.
And, zombie should be big.
Zombie's going to be huge. I want to do a Sasquatch. A Sasquatch that's 103 pounds.
You know what would be cool is if you could put hair all around that bar so when you look at it, it looks like you're holding like someone's hair and you're just fucking throwing it around. And the edge of it is like someone got decapitated. You're doing, remember like, the decapasac? Remember the decapasac? Yeah. And it looks like you're just a fucking, you got two of them and you're just chopping heads off and shit. The Vlad the Impaler series.
And maybe we can make like little wigs for them. Little wigs.
That would be huge, too.
Wigs that you could put on.
And then the end has to be just like skin hanging and stuff. But yeah. It's got to be balanced, though. It's going to be hard.
Well, a really good kettlebell would be one that had like a rubber skin around it that was super durable, but it was like a rubber, like a rubber.
It only lasts like a year and a half, and then you got to get, you got to keep gotta
get
cream
re-skinned.
On it. It comes with cream that you put on it once a month. You got to take care of it and shit.
So the new howler monkey is 18 pounds. So it's 18 pounds. There's a 36-pound chimp, the 54-pound orangutan, and 72-pound gorilla. They're all done in these things called poods, which are a Russian series of measurement, which thank God they don't only use anymore. I used to just say like one pood, two pood, and everybody's like, what the fuck? I got to Google a pood?
Yeah.
The gorilla is the motherfucker, though. That's the one I use.
You use the gorilla?
Two pood, yeah.
72 pounds.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Christ.
I use that for alternating cleans, son.
Was that the one that you posted a photo of yesterday?
No, that was one of my regular ones.
You could take a hot chick's head and open up the mouth, go psh, psh, psh.
I have two different gyms at my house. The gym and the house with the weights. I just have regular kettlebells. And then one in the garage with the MMA equipment. That's all the gorilla ones.
They were talking about you on Opie and Anthony on the way over here. I was listening about you doing kettlebells today.
Why were they talking about me doing kettlebells?
I don't know, just how sexy that photo was.
Sexy. You need to put out some kind of kettlebell. Oh, you're doing it. You sell them. What am I talking about? I was just thinking, you need to sell some kettlebells. What an idiot. See, I smoke too much. I told you guys.
No,
fuck.
You're fine. You're fine. Dude, don't panic.
I told you.
Use the offer code Rogan, the code, bonus code, whatever it is. Rogan, R-O-G-A-N, save 10%. Any and all supplements. All right, we love the fuck out of you, and we're ready to start this shit. Now.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
Good googly moogly, Eddie Bravo. Good googly moogly.
What does that mean?
That's Joey Diaz's thing. He says, now everybody's saying it. And if people say it all the time, when you see something fucking crazy, he goes, good googly moogly. And so it's stuck.
I haven't heard that yet. That must be brand new.
It's a fairly recent one, and Joey's been doing it for the past. Like, I'm sure it's an old saying. Like, you remember the Susquehanna hat store one that he went off about the weed being Susquehanna weed? We didn't know what the fuck that meant. I bet good googly moogly is like that. It's probably something that dudes used to say to each other.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I've heard that.
You remember good googly moogly?
Yeah, I think they used to say it in cartoons a lot, actually, like old Looney Tunes.
Now that you're saying that, I kind of remember that.
Googly moogly.
Yeah, where did okay, let's Google the origin of good googly moogly. What? Do you think that would possibly
I bet everything comes up, man.
All right.
Yeah, right?
Here's a...
Okay, let's see. The origin of good googly moogly. Right. Yep. Urban Dictionary. Wow.
Going anywhere for a while.
What are you doing?
Googly moogly.
What are you playing?
It's a commercial that has it on there.
You spell it.
Yeah. Look. It's old man.
Not going anywhere for a while? Great googly moogly.
Is that something that Mr. Magoo would say?
Something like that, yeah. I remember I think my grandfather used to say it or something, or it used to be in the old Looney Tunes.
Well, it's in the Urban Dictionary, and a phrase used when a real thick female walks by and you want to say, damn.
That's like an updated.
That's what it says. Yeah. They've basically co-opted it. They hijacked it. Great, I mean, googly moogly origin.
How long is it going to take for Joey Diaz to be like an A-list actor? Just a tremendous phenomenon. Yeah, exactly, right?
Who's here's the origin. Here's the origin. Great googly moogly's in Frank Zappa's song, Nanook Rubs It. The song was released in 1974.
Play it.
The term is now used as an utterance of great surprise. Huh. Wow.
I like the first definition better.
Yeah, well, that works today. That's the Urban Dictionary version of it.
So when you see a girl, you can say something out loud.
Good googly moogly.
Yeah, you can, and it's not offensive. How could a girl get pissed off at that?
Like, especially you said, if you're not looking at her.
Yeah. You know what, Rasan, hanging out with a couple Brazilian guys, and there's one Brazilian guy that he says, would his pickup line was, my God. Like, he would just go, my God. That works in Brazil great, but not in the States. My God.
That's all you need in Brazil.
That's all you need. Exactly. You just grab them and you just take them. The girls are used to that shit.
What is it about Brazil that's so
there's
aggressive?
Way more girls in those countries. Like, in Brazil and Argentina are very similar in that there's way more girls than there is guys. In the beginning, when we first started training jiu-jitsu, the Machados, we'd hear all these stories about Brazil, and we all thought jiu-jitsu was as big as soccer in Brazil based on what they were telling us. And they'd say, man, when you go to Brazil, 11 girls for every guy is incredible. And we're like, what? So all these Americans and shit, dudes, Carlos Machado's guys, all the Texas guys are like, we got to go to Brazil. So in 2000 we went to check it all out, and it's true, there is a you just see that there's more girls than
guys. That like statistically,
it's got to be, because you see it, and you even see it more in Argentina. I was in Argentina 3 years ago, and you see just droves and gangs of girls just all together, but they react different to the situation in Argentina than Brazil. In Brazil, it's a lot easier to make moves on chicks in Brazil, but in Argentina, it backfired. So girls are, in Argentina, they're just like, they don't trust dudes at all, because dudes can easily have multiple girlfriends, and prostitution is totally legal. So girls in Argentina are pissed off, and they're like, why should I trust you? You're going to definitely have other girlfriends, and if I piss you off, you're going to go right to the whorehouses. Prove to me that you know, so
wow.
They're pissed off, the girls. That's my experience in Argentina.
Well, that's the one argument, I mean, against prostitution, is that it forces... It allows, rather, guys to not be forced into relationships. Like, how do you develop meaningful relationships and have children and all that jazz if there's legalized prostitution everywhere? Because if you've got a couple of bucks and someone starts talking shit, you just go, okay. You know, you start going, I don't need this. I don't need someone in my life yelling at me just so I can get my sex. I can just go right over there and get my sex.
The guy that was taking us around in Argentina, we had a guide. He said that it's very typical that you go out on a date with a chick. You just, you know, you try the civilians. You try them out. Say, you know, the whorehouses are always going to be there. So he said he would just take a girl to a club and need to be dancing. And if, you know, he'd start putting his hands on the dance floor and try to grab her ass. And if she wasn't into it, if she didn't respond, he would just say, I'm going to the bathroom, and just go right out and jump in a cab and go right to the whorehouse. He had no patience. That's what he's telling us. So that's why the girls are so pissed, because girls are used to that. Girls are used to guys just saying, okay, I'm out. You know, they're like, they don't have to take any, they don't have to beg, basically.
What does that do to a culture? That's very strange when you stop and think about it. You know, because I'm a person that believes totally in personal freedom. And I don't think there's anything wrong with someone being a prostitute if they want to be a prostitute. I think if you were working at Denny's serving people food for fucking $3 an hour, or someone says, hey, you're getting $100 an hour, you could fuck a bunch of nice guys. You know, why not? Why not do that? I'm not saying that it should be something that people pursue, but why is it okay just to give someone a hug? Why is it okay to give someone a massage? And it's not okay to suck their dick. Why is
you
it
have a
you
great point
pay,
there, Joe.
You can pay for a massage. Someone who doesn't want to touch you rubs on you for an hour and a half. But you're telling me that, first of all, we both know there are crazy girls out there that probably love to blow a bunch of guys all day. They exist.
They do porn.
Yeah, I don't know why they exist, but they exist. You could say they exist because of abuse. You could say they exist because of childhood neglect. That's possible. I agree. But they exist. And it's not like you're supporting that market by creating whorehouses. Like the market, that those people are going to be there no matter what you do unless you clean up society. So you're always going to have people that are off the rails. Why not?
Disease, why not have porn? Disease,
that's is that the big one? Disease?
Yeah,
yeah,
because you have to control the disease. With a back massage, you're not getting fucking AIDS.
And well,
isn't that crazy that you would think out of all the people on the planet, hookers would be the first to get AIDS? And it's they're not really getting AIDS. Isn't that crazy?
I don't know if anybody's really checking on hookers. Going like, hey, how you doing?
I think they do. They are. Well, you know, you listen to that guy you had on your podcast, Duisberg. He said in Brazil, virtually none of the hookers have AIDS.
I don't know if he's going down there with a fucking pap smear. That motherfucker's jacking anybody. I don't know about Duisberg, man. I do not know. I found the conversation with him to be absolutely fascinating and very confusing. And I, you know, use the phrase, I hate it when I'm too dumb to know who's stupid. You know, yeah. I don't know if this one guy has it nailed and all these other doctors are out of their mind and they're all chasing a disease that doesn't exist. That doesn't make enough sense to me. It doesn't make enough sense when this guy starts talking about HIV and that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, but yet everyone else thinks it does. Like, there's like serious peer-reviewed scientists that think it does. So that confuses the shit out of me.
Yeah, he makes a lot of sense, though.
He makes a lot of sense. That's what's even scarier.
Break it down.
That's what's even scarier.
You know, the debate him and Callan had, I mean, it seemed at the very end of that, it seemed like as skeptical as Brian is, it seemed like at the very end, based on your podcast, it sounded like he was starting to sort of believe him.
It's a bad situation. First of all, it's unfair because Brian is not a geneticist. He has no engineering background or no bio engineering background. He has no idea what Duisberg does for a living. Like, his concept of like how it all works is so rudimentary. It's like, for him to debate a guy like that, it's not fair. He shouldn't have been doing it. I wanted to have him on because he's a smart dude, and
you should get someone to debate him. Like,
yeah, I tried. Nobody wants to do it. It's really hard. I hired, one of the reasons why we started working with Matt Staggs is that very reason, to be able to get guests like that, to be able to get you know, use a publicist to reach out and let someone know there's a legitimate show. We're trying to get to the bottom of something. No one wanted to touch it.
Yeah.
No one. One guy wanted to touch it, and then he had all this backlash, apparently, from his peers. People don't want you even debating Duisberg. They think that it's almost like debating a Holocaust denier, you know, debating someone you know, who believes really dangerous shit. And so they think that what his work has done has killed many, many people. I don't buy that, though. My problem with I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. But these people that say, you know, Duisberg is responsible for all these people in Africa not taking their medication and all dying. His points about Africa were really fascinating. He was talking about how in Africa they say that everyone has AIDS, but they're not testing for HIV. They're assuming these people have AIDS because their immune system is trounced. But you're also dealing with people that are exposed to a wide variety of other disorders and diseases, and they have terrible, terrible, terrible nutrition. And these people are not getting proper health care. And when you see they're sick, if they have AIDS, in quote, at least, you know, that qualifies for them to have funds, for them to get funding. If you're dealing with an AIDS epidemic, you get money. Get money from charities for an AIDS epidemic. You don't get money, you know, based on the fact that people aren't eating right. You don't get money based on the fact their immune system sucks because they're in a fucking tropical jungle. I talked to this disease expert when I was doing that sci-fi show, and he said that people who live in jungles, like people who live in tropical environments, 100% of them have diseases. 100%. He's like, they've all got something. He goes, everyone has something. And I was like, what do you mean, like, something? He's like, there's all sorts of different diseases. There's undiagnosed diseases. There's ailments that they just live with. There's parasites that get in their system. It's just they get it. That's what, like, the toxoplasma thing that we talked about.
Yeah.
That's why. It's like that kind of environment.
How does a chick that lives in the Amazon jungle get into a river and not have vaginal parasites? Right. How is that possible? They got to be covered with vaginal parasites. That must be a problem in the jungle.
You probably already have them from drinking water.
Does it make their pussy feel better?
No, it gives you fucking
like bumpy.
Bunch
in there.
Of worms in there.
Dick, dick parasites, dick leeches. Like you have dick barnacles. Leeches, little tiny microscopic ones that you dudes pull out on their own, and, go, and every time they pull one out, it's joking around.
You're not joking around, man.
I'm just saying there must be.
No, yeah. Listen, man. When dudes piss in the Amazon, they have to cover their dick. You have to piss into your hand. You got to cover your dick because fish will swim up your urethra.
Tapeworms coming out of your penis hole.
That's not bullshit. They find your urine and they swim upriver into your dick, and then they have to cut them out.
Why do they need? Isn't it? Wouldn't it be easier if they weren't pissing?
Dude, the world is trying to kill you.
No, but if you weren't pissing and you're in the lagoon, isn't it easier?
But you can't find the hole. It follows the river of piss. Swims up the river. It's evolved
like
to follow
salmon.
The river like salmon. To swim up to your mighty... I used to have a Gonorrhea joke about salmon. That. I used to have a joke about that. And I didn't know there was a real disease that did that. I used to joke about it being at a strip club and peeing really hard because I was scared that the VD from the toilet was going to swim up river into my dick.
That's hilarious.
But I didn't know that they really... Like something actually does
That's
that.
Pre-weed Rogan right there.
That is. That's 99 Rogan. But there's actually a fish that does that, like a parasite.
Oh,
what is it called? It swims Jesus. Into your dick. Okay, let's find out. Swims.
You can't be banging Amazon chicks. You're
which
insane.
Called Amazon fish you know swims into your dick.
You know the kind of condom you would need? You would need a fucking NASA would have to make that condom.
It's made out of Levi's.
It'd have to be one of those condoms that are actual shorts, too. It's one piece. They're like booty shorts and a condom all in one.
Oh, this thing is
And
so
then you'd
scary.
Have to tape that. It'd be too hard, dude.
It's called the Candiru. The Candiru is a toothpick fish or vampire fish, a species of parasitic freshwater catfish native to the Amazon basin where it's found in countries of Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. Jesus Christ.
Oh, geez.
Swims. Wow. The smaller species are known for a tendency to invade, alleged tendency to invade parasites and parasites the human urethra. However, despite ethnological reports dating back to the late 19th century, the first documented case of the removal of the candiru from a human urethra did not occur until 1997. And even that incident has remained a matter of controversy. So it might be bullshit.
Dude, they might have anal catfish.
Well, look at that thing. How's that going to get in the tip of your dick unless you want it to?
My shit's big.
That could definitely get into vaginas.
Yeah. Yeah, if girls be in there.
Fucking Amazon chick.
Wow, this is weird. Okay, so this might totally be bullshit. Historical accounts. Earliest published reports of this candiru attacking human host comes from the German biologist C.F.P. von Martius in 1829, who never actually observed it, but rather was told about it by the natives of the area, including that men would tie a ligature around their penis while going into the river to pretend this was happening. You know what that meant? That meant dudes were they had cock rings on, they got busted. And they're like, no, there's a fish.
Dude.
Fry up your dick.
Dude, we sound like we're about to take a trip into the Amazon, and one dude's all into banging Amazon chicks, and you're like, dude, look at this, man. Like, no, it's bullshit. I totally believe it. It makes sense.
Yeah,
I believe all that
shit. It kind of does, but it seems like there was only one case where one was pulled out of a dude's dick.
Maybe they're just comfortable with them, and they just live with them. They just know them.
Well, let's Google up candiru removed from dick.
There's probably a guy that put it in his dick.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. Yeah. That's what they're saying. They're saying
punching Amazon girl vaginal parasite.
Ooh,
Here's something on AOL.com about an eel that swam up somebody's penis and it had to be surgically removed.
Okay, well, hold on a second. There's a penis removal video. Yeah, dude. Oh, my God. Go to this. Candiru penis removal operation.
Oh, no.
Yes, yes, yes. Get to that. Candiru, C-A-N-D-I-R-U, penis removal operation. Good googly moogly is all I have to say. This is fucking crazy, man. This is fucking crazy. Did you get it? Click on this. Wait to see this shit. They got one of them scopes, and so they're going down this guy's urethra. Oh. And look, he's got a fish. He's got a little baby fish camped out inside his pecker.
Oh my God!
Can you imagine in your fucking piss hole? This guy. Oh my God! It's got eyes. It's a fucking fish. Jesus Christ.
Ugh.
There's a fish in this guy's dick. This is madness. This is fucking madness. This is a real thing. This fish really does swim into your dick, and you got to send this dude in there with a vacuum cleaner with a camera in the end of it to suck it out of there. And then the fish is swimming away from your dick.
Is this in the Amazon or what?
It says...
Where does this happen?
Yes. It said it lodged in the penis of Silvio Barbosa after urinating in the Amazon River tributary. Dr. Anwar Samad removes the Kandiru fish in a two-hour operation. Dude, he's got to keep going in there. Look at how many they're in there.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. It's like his ass is packed with dicks. But it's not. It's his penis packed with fish.
Couldn't you just like put a poison in that killed them all?
And that would kill your dick too, stupid.
Yeah. It had to be something. You
don't inject poison into your dick. What if it breaks your dick? You got to let the bad man with the vacuum cleaner go in there and do his business.
Well, how did they deal with it before doctors?
They didn't.
They would just die?
They just die.
Rotten dick.
Yeah, they just have a fish living in their dick. You're not getting it out. What are you going to do? You're going to send a fucking fish hook in there?
Maybe a shaman could do something.
Put a little baby cat.
Blow on it. Blow some.
That would probably work.
Ayahuasca dust on it.
This last weekend's UFC. You know Hootsie? Do you know who he is?
Hootsie.
He's an AKA striking coach.
No.
You know that guy?
Uh-uh.
He's a badass striking coach. And
I thought
really
it was something Mendez or something.
That's Javier Mendez. Yeah, but he did some stuff with him too. I forget his last name. But anyway, this dude got KO'd, and he was like singing a song for him.
Was it his fighter?
He was out. No.
It was the other dude's fighter.
He was taking care of, you know, corners and shit. And so you know how they have a bunch of different guys who are trainers or commission guys who are you know taking care of various things like cut men and stuff like that, and they run in, take care of corners, do various things.
So they're not that night. He wasn't part of a team.
He wasn't with that guy.
He was with the commission.
Exactly. So the I don't know his exact business he was doing there. Anyway, when the dude was out, he was singing him an ayahuasca song.
Nice.
And I talked to him about it, and he's like, he's in the place of the dreams. You know, I tried to make him comfortable, give him comfort while he's there. You know, be serious about it. It's pretty intense. You know, he's an ayahuasca shaman. So he does like ceremonies and shit.
Damn.
Yeah. So it was pretty cool.
How often do you see this
weird
guy?
I see him all the time.
Tell him I'm interested in doing a ceremony with him.
Oh, he'll do it. Yeah.
Down.
We'll come down. Yeah, bring him down to LA.
Dean Lister wants to do a ceremony.
I'm not
ceremony.
Doing it with him.
Why not?
You know, too much troubles.
Too much troubles, really?
Dean, MMA fighter. He's. I'm just kidding. I like Dean. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
Is he retired from MMA?
I don't know, but I was with him all weekend in China for Abu Dhabi.
Did he compete?
Yeah, he did.
How did he do?
He did great. He had four or five heel hooks. He didn't win the gold medal in anything, but he may have gotten third in his division.
Dean Lewis is a badass grappler.
Tough dudes this year. Holy shit. China stinks. And if I never go back there again, I mean, it stinks like literally. Like my bathroom and my hotel stunk like the sewer. It was like the water, they turn off the water and then they turn it on. But the people are beautiful in China. They're beautiful. But they just have a problem in Beijing with their sewers, man. It's just, whoo, you walk down the street and every block, you're like, whoa, Jesus. What is
there just too many people?
Did someone die or did someone take a shit? I don't know if it's that. It's just old. But Abu Dhabi was amazing. The tournament, Jesus Christ. It was so much. So, I mean, you know, Amir Alam, one of my brown belts, fought in the heavyweight division, and he trained his ass off, man. He was ready. He was on fire. And we get an unknown in the first round. So we're thinking, awesome. We should beat this guy. We didn't. His last name was Dopp, Jared Dopp. We thought, okay, we should be able to beat this guy. Because he could easily had Cyborg in the first round.
Right.
He could easily had Buchecha in the first round. That would have been, fuck, okay. Good luck, you know. But
and for people who don't understand, there's a bunch of cyborgs.
Oh yeah,
you only heard of Cyborg, the woman fighter.
And there's an MMA cyborg too.
Her ex-husband is an MMA fighter named Cyborg. But there's a Roberto Abreu, is that how you say
yeah,
his name?
Yeah.
Badass jiu-jitsu.
He won the absolute. He's amazing. Yeah. This guy impressed the shit out of me. He's so big. He's a fucking ox, but he moves like a gazelle, dude. Yeah. It was incredible. There's a couple passes that he did just blew my mind. I'm like running it in. I'm on the plane on the way back going over that pass. I go, I can't forget that pass. I got to analyze it. It was amazing tech. There was at least 10 different techniques where I logged it in my brain. I got to go back and check that one out. Like Cobrina, the guy who won it all in the lightweight, he finally beat Rafa Mendez, man. Rafa Mendez won the last 2 years. He's virtually indestructible. Him and Cobrina were in the finals again, and Cobrina won. He pulled it out. A judge's decision at the end. They couldn't score any points on each other. They just canceled each other.
What do you think about those, though? Aren't those weird when the judges make a score?
And yeah.
I have a real problem with that.
Well, the one thing I love about Abu Dhabi is the Sheik he's such a badass. The Sheik just decides to put together the best jiu-jitsu tournament on the planet. He just makes it happen. He pays for it. It's all over the world. 1 year it's in Sao Paulo. 1 year it's in Barcelona. It's in L.A. It's in China. It's amazing. The Sheik just throws down and he makes shit happen. And he created the rules and the format based on what he thought would be best for the entertainment value. So he's down to evolve. Over the years, he's tweaked stuff. He's like the Japanese. The Japanese in Pride, as soon as they recognize a problem, they fucking change it.
For people who have no idea what we're talking about, the Abu Dhabi is Abu Dhabi Combat Championships, right?
Abu Dhabi Combat Club.
They have the biggest jiu-jitsu, no-gi jiu-jitsu tournament in the world. They have this huge thing, and it's put together by, how do you say his name?
Tak Noon. Yeah.
He is also part owner of the UFC, and he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's a huge jiu-jitsu fan. Yeah. So he put together like this enormous grappling competition that's the most prestigious grappling event in the world. And so Eddie was just there in China with one of your fighters. Yeah. So how did he do against this dude?
Well, let me finish what I was saying about the Sheik. We're getting to the format, the rules.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the coolest thing that he changed was the same day weigh-in. He changed that shit. And not only is it, because generally, especially in MMA and pro MMA, you weigh in officially the day before. And then you have 24 hours to recover. So that's huge in deciding what weight category you're going to compete in and how you're going to lose the weight and how you're going to, it's massive. If you have to do a same day weigh-in, ooh, shit. Everything changes now. You can't have that crazy diabolical cut that you're used to. Now it's a little different. And the IBJJF changed it too. They make it, you weigh in right before you step on the mat. And if you weigh even a pound over, boom, you're gone. So Abu Dhabi, the Sheik, he did the same thing. You do, not only is it same day weigh-ins, but you got to weigh in the day before, the day of, and the next day if you make it to the third round. You have to keep weighing in.
I was going to say, because it seems kind of dangerous if you just did it right before you went in, because some guys would still probably push themselves to be, you know what I mean?
It's risky, because you see these high-level grapplers every now and then you see them gas, and they try to cut too much weight, and you don't have that much time to recover. So if you're going to do a same-day weigh-in, especially mat-side weigh-in, man, you just got to get in the best shape of your life and figure out what weight that is, and you really can't cut, really, or you're going to pay for it. You're going to gas out. And some people still take the chance, though. But with the rules, the Sheik decided the best thing to do to ensure action most of the time, because no matter how you put together the rules, not every match is going to be exciting. You have to accept that. But you're always looking to make the majority, you're striving for the majority of the matches to be exciting. So in Abu Dhabi, every tournament does shit different. But in Abu Dhabi, they're 10-minute matches. The finals are 20-minute matches. But in these 10-minute matches, the first 5 minutes, there's no points at all. They don't count anything. And the second 5 minutes, that's when the points start. And if you pull guard, you lose a point. So that's huge when strategizing for a fight, because when you're competing in this...
Explain to people why the first 5 minutes, there's no points.
That was instilled so that if there's no points, you'd be... fighters would take more chances, because generally, if there's points counting all the time, you don't want to take any chances. One wrong slip, dude's up 2 points. Now he's up. He's just going to hold. He doesn't really think about the submission. He's just trying to get to the next round. So it changes the dynamics of your strategy and how it all plays out. So the Sheik thought, okay, let's try to shake it up. First 5 minutes, no points. So the fighters will take more chances, and that turns into entertainment for the viewer. So that happens sometimes with some fighters. Jean-Jacques Machado, he took advantage of that. He went out there, pulled guard, and got the party rolling. He's like, okay, I'm going to sit down. You get on top. Let's go. I'm not going to spend 5 minutes trying to take you down. I'm not a wrestler. You wrestled your whole life. Let's just get the party started. I'll let you get on top. I'll kick the ball off to you. I'll let you receive first. How about that? That's all that is. So in the first round, guys will do that. They're like, I'm not going to spend all my energy trying to take a dude down. It's not a wrestling competition. So they sit down. The problem is, in the second half of the match, if you decide to sit down, you lose a point. So the ref goes, points at 5 minutes. So wherever you're at, the next transition, if you already have the guys back at that 5 minute mark, they don't give you the points. You have to lose the back and then get it back. So a lot of weird stuff that I didn't understand. But again, the point of this weird format is to make it better. So the Sheik is always trying to make it better. And the one thing I'm pretty sure he's got to change that losing a point if you pull guard, because that changes a lot. We saw a couple of the finals where both jiu-jitsu guys, world-class jiu-jitsu guys like Cobrina and Hafa, some of the two best guys in the world, very good at submissions, amazing at passing, unbelievable, beautiful jiu-jitsu. What you had in their match is nobody wanted to pull guard, because in the finals, you lose a point right away. They don't give you – it's not the first half, no points.
Well, and that really does come from guys just having shitty guards. It comes from people not realizing how dangerous a guard is if a guy's a real bad motherfucker with it.
Yeah, and we saw that too. One of the competitors came in. He's a 22-year-old kid. Him and his brother are real famous. They just got their black belts. They're the Meow brothers. They're like Machida, like half Japanese, half Brazilian from Brazil. Like
Meow, like a kitty cat, yeah, Meow?
But it's like Sao Paulo, Meow. But okay. It's not really like Meow Meow Cat. It right. Could be, but it's spelled, I think, M-I-Y-A-O.
They should get Brian to design their shirts.
Totally. Well, these guys, all they do is pull guard and play De La Hiva and spiral guard relentlessly. They don't stop. That's all they do. They're relentless. They have an infinite amount of cardio, and that's his style. He sits out. He has zero wrestling. So that's why he lost. He lost because, bam. So what ends up happening with this rule set, which was aimed at making it more entertaining, but what's happening now, and I'm sure the Sheik's going to see this because everyone's talking about it on the internet. I'm not the only one. Everyone's talking. Everyone, as they were watching, everyone came to the same conclusion. They're like, oh, there's a problem here. We got a problem. The Sheik is one of those guys that will fix it, and he's got to fix it. Because the problem was, we had Cobrina and Hafa in the finals, and they just tried to take each other down, and they couldn't because they're not wrestlers. The wrestling is decent, you know, but according to dudes who know wrestling, like dudes who wrestled in college, they'll say they're at like a high school state champion level, you know, not D1 All-American Johnny Hendricks level, right?
Right.
Whole different animal. Yeah. So what we end up getting is 20 minutes of two dudes who have okay wrestling, you know, like D5 wrestling, going at it, and we don't see any jiu-jitsu because
no one took anyone down.
They don't want to pull guard.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's way easier to not get taken down than to take someone down. It's way easier. Like, if your whole focus is, I'm not going to get taken down, and you're going to take me down, even if you wrestled in college, and I didn't wrestle in college, it's still going to be hard for you to, of course, I have to work on it, but you can get that takedown defense a lot quicker than you can
takedown ability.
Exactly. Takedown ability, man, that takes a long, long, long time. Sprawling can come easier. So what you end up having is two dudes that were wrestling for a very long time. They got to the ground briefly a couple times, and they went to double overtime, triple overtime. It went forever, and at the very end, 0-0, the ref makes the decision and gave it to Cobrina. So
how does that work? How can a ref make a decision like that? That's how we got started off. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense to me. I don't buy that.
Yeah.
How does that guy walk away with a win? I mean, I understand that they were, you know, they're the elite of the elite and two of the best in the world. I guess someone has to win.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, the rules need revamping, and I'm quite positive that the Sheik is going to take that, because what you end up having, if you don't lose a point for pulling guard, it's, you know, losing a point for pulling guard is like this. I use a football analogy when I'm trying to explain jiu-jitsu to someone who doesn't know anything about jiu-jitsu. Do you understand the rules of football and the strategy? And most Americans do. So it's just like football. Generally, a guy has a ball, and the team has the ball, and they're marching down the field, and then a team is defending, trying not to let them march down the field. Same thing. Guy on top in jiu-jitsu is trying to march down the field. Guy on bottom is playing defense. The guy on defense can score, but it's not it's a lot easier to score when you're on top and you can use your weight because it's like you have the ball. You're scoring. But the defensive football team can intercept and run back for a touchdown. They can score. Some teams are very high. But it's rare. Same thing with the bottom. It's rare that there's guys that can score a lot off their back. But generally, you want to be on top. You want to have the ball. If you're on top, you're in someone's open guard. It's like you're on the 20-yard line. You get on to top half, you're like at the 50-yard line. You pass the side control. You can score from side control, but it's a lot easier if you score from the back. So side control is like the 35-yard line. The mount is like the 20-yard line. Now you're in the red zone. And if you get the dudes back, first and goal on the 10. That's basically, it's the same thing. You're marching down the field. You're getting into scoring position. Yes, you can score from midfield. You know, you could score from top half. You could throw guillotine. You can throw darces. But it's easier when you're on their back. It's easier when you're right there on the 10-yard line. So in football, the way they start the game is the ref flips a coin. One of the teams picks heads or tails. And I think it's the visiting team. And then if it's heads, whoever wins the coin toss gets to decide who receives and who kicks off. Generally, a large percentage of the time, if you win the coin toss, you say, we're going to receive and you're going to kick off. We're going to be on offense first. You're going to be on defense first. I'm going to be on top in your open guard. You're going to be on the bottom. You flip a coin, you have to choose. Fuck yeah. Generally, I would too.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that you should do a match where you flip a coin, decide.
No. What I'm saying is, sometimes a team will choose to kick off and not receive. That's kind of like if we're going to grapple and I sit down, I chose to play defense first. That's what a guard puller is. It doesn't happen that often. So it's penalizing someone 1 point for sitting on their butt, for letting the guy get on top. He's working to get on top. He worked very hard on his wrestling to get on top. The dude is saying, I'm kicking off to you. You receive. I'm going to let you go first. That's like a team saying, we're going to kick off to you and losing 3 points for it. Like you're already giving them an advantage. You're going to lose the advantage and points. Doesn't make any sense. You understand what I'm saying?
I could see if so say if they don't have points, you know, if they don't score points, you know, with their idea of advantage, maybe you could say you could give someone an advantage. If a guy pulled guard,
it's still a point. Is it a point? If you give an advantage, you still won. Maybe, if it's 0-0 with the guy who has the advantage
that's a
wins.
Stupid analogy, actually.
Really, it should be like this. It should be like this. It should either be submission only. That's it, and you have overtime rounds. And I could explain that if you want to hear. But generally, you have submission only. No points. No advantages. It's all about who gets the submission. The whole goal is to get submission because epic matches. There's incredible athletes. I have respect for all of them. But when you're under this rule set, there's a lot of times in these matches where the submission wasn't even a thought, just the W. There were matches where there's like 3 minutes left, guy sat on his ass, he loses a point. Now I'm on top. I want to win that money at the end because the winner of each division wins $10,000. The guy on top automatically is going to be very cautious, reserved, and not be aggressive, and definitely not even consider a submission. It's all about the W. So that changes the entertainment value. And for me, that's the most important thing.
Do you think that it should be just submission only?
Either submission only, or you really, really break down the point system for the way it should be. And this is the way it should be. Like in Dean Lister's match against, I forget who he lost. There were so many matches, but he was down on points. And at the very end, he put, I think it was João Assis. He put him in a triangle. He had him in a cinch triangle at the very end. And he was down by 2 points, maybe three. I'm not sure on the points, but he was down. It was 30 seconds. Put him in a triangle. In my eyes, a triangle you should get more, anything cinched, like a triangle, a figure. If your legs are cinched, like you have a guy in a triangle, doesn't mean he's going to tap. A lot of times some guys escape. But if it's totally cinched, that guy was in deep, deep trouble. If he escapes, he got lucky. So that cinched triangle should represent way more than a pass or a sweep. That's just common sense. So in my eyes, if you want to score, keep the scoring system, and you're in love with, you're going to commit to the scoring system, really think about the score, how you score this. If a pass is 3 points, if a sweep is 2 points, a cinched darce, which people escape half the time, but if you cinch it all the way up, and as a referee, you should see if it's a near sub. If it's a cinched darce, a cinched triangle, a cinched arm triangle, a straightened out arm, like you straighten the guy's arm and he escaped by the skin of his teeth. You straightened out his leg like a knee bar. He escaped by the skin of his teeth. You can see that. I wouldn't count heel hook and toe hold attempts because then that would, you know, they're so easy to just to jump on and then it turns into just a bunch of footsies. But if you, I would count in my world, I would count straight knee bars, straight arm bars, anything cinched, any that should be 7 points.
Yeah, I agree with you. So right? I think it should five something. It should be like a lot football. More than one.
Yeah, a pass.
So what is it now? It's one?
No. Anything cinched is not in Abu Dhabi. There's nothing.
What?
It means nothing.
Wait a minute.
It means nothing.
That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. It doesn't mean anything? So if a guy has a cinched in triangle, that's not a near submission?
Mm-mm.
That's ridiculous. Why do we have that? Those rules are terrible.
Shouldn't it be? It should be worth way more than a sweep.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, you look, sweeps, you know, people recover from sweeps. But if someone has you that close to being tapped, like a cinched rear naked or something along those lines.
That's like a goal.
Yeah.
Like a touchdown.
You got out of it, but goddamn, that guy got to an incredibly dominant position.
Exactly. That should be, and Naga is into evolution, and so is Grappler's Quest. Grappler's Quest are doing selected super fights, submission only. So submission only is starting to spread. The Gracie Nationals is submission only. Gracie World is submission only. Sub League up in the Pacific Northwest is submission only. Midwest Submission Challenge, which are doing submission only tournaments all over the Midwest. It's growing. It's growing. But if you're still committed to points, like Naga, they did change up and tweak the point system. They are giving, I think, 1 point, maybe two, for a near sub, which they're on the right track. You're on the, whoever's running Naga, your Kip Collar, you're definitely on the right track. Let's turn it up a little bit more. Let's make cinched darces, cinched triangles, 7 points. It makes sense. That's like a touchdown. A sweep is two.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. We're both on the same page.
So besides that, the tournament, Abu Dhabi ADCC is the most prestigious on the planet. If it wasn't for that tournament, I wouldn't be sitting here. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, it just seems like those rules are just, they need to be revised. That's all. Yeah. Now, tell me about Cron Gracie.
That's what I was about to tell you. You read my mind.
No, I'm looking at a video of him.
Cron Gracie versus Gary Tonin. Gary Tonin's a 21-year-old dude who he shocked everybody. That match was probably the greatest grappling match of all time. Gary Tonin and Cron Gracie. Cron Gracie gets his arm, straightens it out. He looks like he's going to break
it. Spoiler alert.
Well, you don't want me to talk about it?
Just kidding.
No, trust me. It doesn't even matter.
He
straightened his arm out. He wouldn't tap. They kept rolling, straighten his arm out. Everyone's going nuts. Everywhere he rolls, the arm, Cron is right there at every angle with the arm totally straight. It looked like it's going to break. Everybody's going, oh. He didn't just hold it and escape. Dude, they were rolling all over the place, and that arm should have broke off. Dude, he survived. He didn't tap. Gets on top. Takes Cron's back. Puts him in the truck. Almost has Cron in a twister.
Oh my God.
Cron spins out. He goes back to the bag, puts an anaconda on him, aka triangle body lock on him, has Cron face down. It looks over. Hickson's sitting there going, oh, damn. And in the first match, that was Cron's second match. In his first match, Cron demolished Andy Wang. I love you, Andy Wang, but he went right through him like in 30 seconds. And Hickson didn't even move. He's sitting there and he went right through Andy Wang, and Hickson didn't even move. And I was like looking at Hickson. I'm like, man, that's way doper than getting all excited. Him not doing anything, like, he expects it. It's no big deal. You went right through him. The best possible outcome. Hickson didn't even make a move like Yoda. And I admired that. I'm like, wow, that's deep right there. He's not even happy, not even a smile. But in this match, Hickson was like visibly shaking. You could see him going, what? He's watching.
Where's this kid come out of?
I think he's from the East Coast. I'm not sure, but he was on that BJJ Kumite thing with Heenan Cornelius, who also did amazing at Abu Dhabi. But anyways, back to Garrett. Dude, there's a minute left. And at this point, a minute and a half, and Kron is doing everything to try to escape. We're watching Kron be defeated right now. We're watching him be defeated after he almost had that dude's arm like five different times. Kron's struggling. He can't get out. Gary Tonin's back defenses or back control is professional, assassin-like. Kron cannot get out, but by the skin of his teeth, I have to see it again. I don't know exactly how I got, but he got out. They stand up. Hickson looks at him and goes, you got 1 minute. Kron turns around, dude, takes him down, passes his guard. It takes a while. He gets his back. Dude, he squoze. With 2 seconds left, Gary taps.
Wow.
It was the craziest submission match I've ever seen.
It's really fascinating watching Kron. For people who don't know, his dad is the greatest jiu-jitsu guy of all time. There's one guy that's always thought of above all others in the world of jiu-jitsu. It's Hickson Gracie.
You got to have him on this podcast.
I would love to have him on.
It would be easy. It would be simple.
He lives in Brazil now, doesn't he?
He's here, right? I don't know. You're right. You're right. I don't know.
But I'll figure it out. I'll get in touch with Kron.
Dude, I would fly him in first class.
Last time I saw Kron, it was at when Hoist fought Matt Hughes in L.A.
Was like 07 or 06.
Yeah. He was a young kid. He was really young. That was right after I had dinner with Hickson once. And I went to his house and watched fights, and he broke down what people are doing wrong.
Dude, you know how crazy that is? You went to Hickson's house, hung out with him, watched fights, and broke down fights. I remember you telling me this.
Yeah.
You were telling me he broke down, because Fedor at the moment was the Mr. Indestructible.
Yeah.
He was on top. Everyone feared him.
Hickson wanted to fight him.
Yeah, and he broke down how to beat Fedor in his mind, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he thought he could beat Fedor. He thinks he could beat anyone. He's a monster.
Yeah.
He's a scary dude.
Yeah.
He's a master. He's a true master of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And he's like that samurai mindset. A lot of people talk that samurai mindset.
Yeah.
That fucking dude lives it. Like that is his mindset.
Yeah. The Gracie family is very large, and there's a lot of sections, a lot of Gracie cliques. There's the Carlson side. There's the Carlo side. There's the Helio side. The Helson side. And a lot of them hate each other. A lot of them talk a lot of crap on each other. But Hickson, man, I don't know how many times I've heard people say, fuck that Gracie. Like a Gracie say, like, fuck that Gracie. Or, or a Brazilian or someone from the old school. Like all the old school guys. But they'll always say, except Hickson. they tell you, except Hickson. Like Alan Goes, man. Alan Goes, he has a lot of problems with people. But he makes it clear. He goes, but Hickson's awesome. Hickson's, because they all say it. They all agree that although there's no roles on video, like now everyone has their roles on video. You could catch them on YouTube. Like you catch Marcelo's roles all day, the greatest jiu-jitsu player ever. But Hickson, not too many roles. But everyone says it's all like myth. It's all legend. But you got to believe it because everyone says the same thing. Even David Camarillo, when he went down there, and David Camarillo's a world-class black belt, he said he couldn't do anything with Hickson.
Yeah, even Paulo Filho said that. Paulo Filho went down there and came back and was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a master. Yeah. He's been doing it since
he was the Brazilian jiu-jitsu community, Hickson is a god. He's the best Gracie, hands down.
Yeah, so he had two sons, and one of them, Hoxson, died a few years back, and he was already on his way to being a badass jiu-jitsu player.
Yeah.
And his youngest son, Kron, over the last couple of years, has just become this fucking beast.
Hickson's son. And I remember when he was 12, outside of a jiu-jitsu tournament, some IBJJF tournament in Dominguez State Hills here in California, me and Jean-Jacques, my master, Jean-Jacques Machado, we were outside. He was, basically giving me a sermon like he always does, and like everything that comes out of his mouth is gospel and everything's perfect, and he just has, he's like a superhero. And we're walking outside and Kron's 12 at this time, and he's messing around on a skateboard, jumping up, doing these skateboard tricks, and John Jock looks over at him and says, "That's the one right there. I tell you, that is the one. He's going to be unstoppable." I'll never forget that. He called it out. And Jean-Jacques also, he's called out a lot of people who you thought were going to be legends. And Jean-Jacques said, he doesn't have what it takes. He's going to break. And I'm like, no way, Jean-Jacques. He's like, watch him break. He's going to break. And damn, he was right. There was a couple that he called out that broke and they just disappeared.
Jean-Jacques can see things. That's a fact.
Jean-Jacques, it really is Yoda.
Yeah.
And he called out Kron. He knew it. And Kron... He is now in a select group that, man, I don't know if there's more than three or four, but he submitted everybody in his weight division. He tapped everybody out. And here's another Hickson story. Well, Jean-Jacques Machado was the first to tap everyone out back in 99 or 2000, one of those Abu Dhabis. 98, 99, Jean-Jacques Machado shows up to Abu Dhabi. He's the first superstar. Back then, everyone was having trouble with the submissions. A lot of the gi champions were having a little trouble submitting dudes without the gi. And the wrestlers, they didn't know how to pass the guard or submit anybody, but they could throw you around and you ain't taking them down. So a lot of boring matches in the early Abu Dhabi. And that's why the Sheik kept changing the rules, trying to work it all out. But then the next god who came and just submitted everybody in 2003 was Marcelo Garcia. He was the second coming of Jean-Jacques. First that was Jean-Jacques, Marcelo Garcia. And now, you know, there have been other guys that have had a bunch of submissions in Abu Dhabi too. Haja Grace, he's done a tremendous job. So many good guys out there. But as far as coming in and just submitting everybody in your division, maybe Haja did it too. I don't know. But Kron Gracie did it last weekend. He went through everybody. And that the Gary Tonin fight, that was a close one, man. He escaped by the skin of his teeth, but that showed how awesome he is and how he can come back. And in the final, you know, first we have Hickson, the first couple matches, he's just real chill, zen. And then when he beat Gary Tonin, you see Hickson jumping up, Kron lifts him up. Yeah, I never seen Hickson so happy.
Gary was trying to get him from the twister without actually, he was trying to get the twister before he even got the lockdown on the back leg. He was thinking about it early. He was thinking about putting, like, as the body triangles wrapped around him, he's thinking of grabbing his neck.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's this kid train out of?
Gary Tonin. Look him up. T-O-N-O-N.
Dude, that transition where he took Kron's back is insane.
And not only, you know what Gary Tonin did? He ended up doing the absolute, and the first round he went against Buchecha, who won the heavyweight division, who is considered the best new heavyweight. Dude moves like a panther. Buchecha is, I think his name is Marco Almeida. Man. You know, some of these Brazilians, I know them by their nickname, but their real name is it's hard to remember sometimes. But Buchecha, he wins the heavyweight division. Now he signs up for the absolute. First round, it's Gary Tonin, who's 170 pounds, against Buchecha, who just won the heavyweight. That's the worst possible draw. The smallest guy gets the biggest guy. And you know what? Buchecha couldn't tap him. Wow. It was a good match. Buchecha got all sorts of position on him, but Gary kept recovering, and Gary kept attacking. And then so he loses that right on points, but he didn't get put away. And the guy I was talking about earlier, Jared Dopp, the guy who beat Amir, he ended up beating Amir, and we were like, fuck, man, we got an unknown. It was perfect. We should have beat this guy. It was a close match. Amir had his back for a second, but didn't get points. He had him in a Kimura, didn't get points for any of that. And the guy took him down once and passed his guard. And Amir lost on points, and it was kind of a shocker. That was the first round. We're like, damn, we got a guy that no one knows that we should have beat him. Damn. Then he gets Vinny Magalhães the next round, Jared Dopp. Wow. He beats Vinny.
Whoa.
So then we're like thinking,
Vinny lost?
Vinny got beat by the guy that beat Amir.
Wow, do you think that's because Vinny's doing so much MMA? He's not doing.
Vinny was not in shape for this. Vinny, he admitted it to me. He didn't train very much at all. He just couldn't turn it down. You know, I'm sure it had a lot to do with him getting cut by the UFC, and that really fucked with his mind for a while.
The last fight was hard. He got knocked out like with the first punch that homeboy threw.
Yeah,
and he never expected that.
Yeah,
he fought Australian gentleman. Fuck's his name?
Anthony Parash.
Anthony Parash.
Yeah.
Anthony Parash, who's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and that's what a lot of people expected. They thought it was going to be a jiu-jitsu versus jiu-jitsu battle.
Yeah.
And he caught Vinny like with the first punch he threw.
He gets cut. He's in a depressive state. He's not really training hard for Abu Dhabi. And Jared Dopp beat him. He's from Rafael Lovato's camp. He's a purple belt.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So he's just an incredible specimen. So he gets Cyborg next. He gets Cyborg next. And he is winning. He's beating him. All he's got to do is survive for 30 more seconds. He would have beat Amir Alam, the top 10 planet heavyweight, Vinny Magalhaes, who won the gold medal in the Absolute in 2011, and then Cyborg. He was going to beat Cyborg. He would have, but at the very end, Cyborg pulled it off, and he impressed the shit out of me. Cyborg ended up winning. He ended up getting third in his weight. Bushesha won, and in the Absolute, Cyborg took it all. He beat Bushesha in the finals. It was,
what did Cyborg catch him with?
He beat him on points. Oh, catch who with? No, just points. So
he was losing until the last few minutes?
Yeah, Jared Dopp was beating him on points. And then I forget how it went down. Again, there was 50 matches. But all I remember, Cyborg came back at the very end and Jared Dopp couldn't hold on. He had it. He just couldn't hold on. And Cyborg pulled it out of his ass. Got some points. I think he took his back or something. Got some good points and barely pulled it off. And then Jared Dopp did the Absolute. And he beats his first guy and maybe a second guy. And then he gets hurt. He has to bow out his shoulder shirt. He was going to get a rematch with Cyborg in the Absolutes.
Wow.
But, you know, since he couldn't go, Gary Tonin, 170-pounder, who lost against Bushesha, who gave him a great match, they call him and go, dude, you're in. And he's like, oh, shit. So now he's going against Cyborg, who's like 240 pounds of pure leopard. You know what I mean? Like tiger.
And yeah, he's built like a brick shithouse.
Oh, yeah.
There's videos of him training, strength and conditioning online.
Yeah.
Pushing sledge and shit.
And you know what? Gary Tonin looked great, man. He was giving Cyborg fits. That guy's going to be a superstar.
Really?
Mark my words, yes. Just remember Gary Tonin.
Cyborg 100%. Being that big, and he must be, how young is this kid?
21.
Wow.
Strong as shit.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He's not even a big guy.
Yeah.
Like I looked at the video of him and Kron. He's just,
looks like
a normal sized guy.
He's out of control. And he plays his best shit is part of the same style that I play. Gary Tonin plays a lot of prison guard. I don't know if he calls it prison guard. That's just what I named it. But it's like a head and arm from the bottom. It's basically a Greco-Roman full guard game. That's what I call it, prison guard. There's no
He's
name
a brown
for
belt.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. And, oh, the way he got Kron's back, the way he got it was through prison guard. And, again, it's not something that I'm sure he names it, but it's something that I named. And it's a head and arm from the top, from the bottom, and you squeeze on it and you shuck that arm that's caught in between your arms. You shuck it over your head. You got to get really good at that. And you can go right to the back, or you could transition to a swim move to spider web. Or if you can't shuck the arm over your head, you could transition right into rubber guard beautifully. Or you could put the far side butterfly in and get some sweep. So it's a very, very strong position. The actual position, the whole style I call prison guard, but the actual position is called homie control. And homie control is the mission control of prison guard. So I play it all the time. And watching Gary Tonin go to it over and over, did it to Cyborg. Cyborg was too big. It didn't really work on him. And then he did it on Bushesha. He kept trying. I'm like, I don't know if prison guard's going to work on a guy that has 100 pounds on you or something, but he kept going to it. So look out for Gary Tonin.
Yeah, it sounds like a kid's a beast. I love that. I love that all these new dudes are just coming up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the cool things about jiu-jitsu is that there's so many guys out there practicing it now.
Yeah.
I think it's about time for someone to put it on TV. I think one of these days they're going to figure out a format, or the guys are going to get talented enough or scary enough where you're going to be able to put it on TV, and it'll be something that could be on.
I think about that all the time, and I've had a show that it's a concept. We had financial backers that were interested, and then they back out. We had a couple other more that were interested, and they back out. They're not sure. But the whole goal of mine with this show is a 16-man tournament. The whole goal is entertainment value, and everything is designed to score. It's a submission-only format. There's a few different ways you can go with submission-only, but the way everything in my mind was all designed to create urgency for the submission. Like, for example, the ultimate urgency would be you do a submission-only match between two guys, and the winner gets $1 billion. The loser gets nothing. You imagine the urgency of that and how exciting that match would be?
Obviously, you don't really mean $1 billion.
No, but I'm just saying. That's an example. Yeah. If you could give them $1 billion, that would be great. But let's say realistically in 50 years, 100 years, 2 years, jiu-jitsu is mainstream. There's like some reality show about jiu-jitsu, and it gets so big and people love it. But we have to figure out the right format first to make sure that there's a lot of excitement. Because right now, you know, you go to jiu-jitsu tournaments, there's nobody there. The only people in the stands are the actual competitors and their girlfriends and maybe their moms. We've been having these world championships forever. Nobody's going to see it because the point system is developed to satisfy the competitor.
Well, it's a little bit of that, but it's also just it hasn't been introduced right.
Yeah.
It hasn't
been
introduced at all. You know, now that Spike is starting to put Glory on, like the highest level kickboxing, they're putting that on TV. I think one of these days someone's going to realize that, watch like that Cron Gracie, Gary Conan fight, that kind of a match is very exciting.
Let's say that, okay, realistically, 50 years or whatever, jiu-jitsu is mainstream. You could do a show where there's a 16-man tournament, submission only, and the winner, one winner only, it's just like any kind of reality show. One winner gets $100,000 cash or whatever. That's not that unrealistic. Can you imagine the excitement of those matches? You have a good matchmaker, you put together, you know, you don't just throw people together, but the amount of urgency that there's going to be for the submission, the training would be totally different. People would be specifically training their setups to these submissions. It would be all about the submission. Right now, these guys, getting the W and winning by points is all that's necessary. So guys are specifically training for the point system. Yeah. And I'm guilty of it too. I mean, if that's the format, I understand, because I do the same thing with Amir Alam. He wrestled his whole life. He's one of my brown belts, but he's a wrestler through and through. So we were going to go in and just say, you're a wrestler. He worked on his wrestling. Let's beat these guys by the point system. Let's get that W. I was doing that. I'm not like this, you know, you're forced to think like that based on the system because you want the W so bad. So you know, I'm guilty of it too. We wanted to wrestle Jared Dobb. So, you know, you make it a 16-man tournament, 8-man tournament, you make it a reality show, submission only, one guy gets $100,000. I mean, if you did
idea.
You know, if you did $1 million, that would even be crazier. The matches would be nuts.
Well, all you'd have to do is just have guys who are really good, who are going for submissions and going after it, and it would be a really exciting sport. A lot more exciting than a lot of shit that is on TV. Yeah. It's just people just don't know about it. They're just not used to it.
Yeah.
It could be done. Someone like the Sheik.
Yeah.
You know, figure out how to do it.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of people that they look into jiu-jitsu and then they watch a match and go, fuck this is boring. They're just, the way the gi sport is turning into now, it's like, I'm a black belt in the gi and I look at the new stuff, I don't even know who's on top. I have no idea who's winning. They're playing tug of war with the pants and they're in this mangled, tangled position that I don't even know who has the advantage. Someone got an advantage for a near sweep. I go, who did? I'm confused.
One of the things I want to ask you about Cron, he doesn't do any new shit. Like, everything he does is old school jiu-jitsu, old school Hicks and Gracie style, that real basic set of techniques, and just it just gets him laser sharp. That's all he does.
Yeah, he has an incredible rear naked choke and even more insane guillotine. In the final, he went against Otavio Souza. He's one of the top Gracie Baja guy at that weight, at the 170. And, getting to this match, right? So it's the finals. Hicks and Gracie sitting there. Cron and Otavio. They're going at it. Otavio decides to get inside Cron's head. And the way he's going to do that is keep staying away from him, not engage, slap him on the neck, push him away, frustrate him. Because all Cron wants is submission.
Right.
He's like Marcelo Garcia. He just goes forward. Right. The submission is on Cron's mind.
Right.
You know, for damn sure. That's what he wants. And He kept going forward. Oteva keeps pushing him away. Oteva's a bad motherfucker. He kept pushed. He beat Lito Vieira. I mean, he's legit one of the best. And he actually, they went against each other in Metamoris. And Kron beat him in the gi. He armbarred him. It was an epic match. And the match before that at the Worlds, Ottavio won. So Metamoris was a rematch. He got revenge. Now, the rubber match in Abu Dhabi, in the final. He's smacking his head, and Kron's looking over at the ref going, you know, what is he doing? Just smacking my neck, and he keeps walking backwards. I understood what Ottavio was doing. He was trying to frustrate him, get inside his head, and it was working. He was getting pissed off, but you know what? It was also working on Hickson, too. Hickson said, hey, and this is according, I didn't hear it personally, but this is according to what I heard, the reports, the reporters, it's all over the internet. So I may be wrong, but it appears to be correct based on the reports I read that Hickson was, at first, he was like telling the ref, he keeps going backwards, he's not engaging, he keeps going backwards, he doesn't even want to fight. And then he said, he's chicken. And then he starts making chicken noises. He's like, pick up. Can you imagine Hickson doing that? Isn't that crazy? You know what that tells you, man? You know, there's some people out there that don't understand that, but as a father, I understand it. I do. It's like, that's your son. You're going to make sure. Like, if my son murdered somebody, I'm going to shelter him. I'm going to hide him. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe you shouldn't talk about that on
what I'm saying is, you do anything for your kids.
I know what you're saying.
Even doing, making chicken noises that could easily make you seem like you're childish. Easily.
Right.
But he don't care. All he cares about is
very macho.
He was willing to do anything it took to make Ottavio engage, and it worked.
Right.
He engaged, took a shot. Kron guillotined him, the fastest guillotine ever. Soon as he took him down, Kron sat down, boom. It was over. Man, I don't know if it's online, but it was over like in 3 seconds or less than 3 seconds.
Wow.
And boom, he won the world championship, submitted everybody.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just amazing when you hear about a guy who's the son of the great master, like the greatest master ever. It's almost like a movie,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when he was young, you know, like I remember hanging out with him over at Hickson's house. You know, he was just like a young kid. He was talking about rap music and shit. And, and of course, he trained jiu-jitsu. He loved jiu-jitsu. He loved the fact that his dad was this... You know, I mean, can you imagine if that's your dad? He's just the greatest jiu-jitsu guy of all time. It's got to be the coolest shit ever.
Yeah. And he's right. He's currently the baddest guy in Abu Dhabi for
damn sure. It's amazing. And he's young, too.
And you
he's
know what?
Better.
No homo or anything, but that guy's he's a beautiful man.
Handsome
absolutely,
man. Well, his wife was beautiful. Hickson's wife was beautiful. Hickson's beautiful.
Yeah, Hickson married some supermodel back in the day, and they had a bunch of kids. And all their kids, even Hoxson and their daughters, they all have perfect little model faces, and they're tan.
Yeah.
He could easily be a movie star. They're models as kids, like Abercrombie and Fitch models. So,
well, when he was in that documentary Choke, if that documentary, it's really unfortunate that didn't become a huge documentary, because even people who don't appreciate martial arts, just want to watch something interesting. Like, people keep telling me about the sushi documentary, Janjiro Dreams of Sushi, or whatever the fuck it's called. It's supposed to be amazing, about a guy who's like really into sushi. But I'm not into sushi. I'm not dying to be a sushi chef.
I hate it.
But even if you have no aspirations towards martial arts, Choke is an amazing documentary, because it follows this guy who's just... He's legit. He's legit masterful in everything he does. I mean, the dude is he's meditating in the fucking freezing, icy rivers of Japan. He gets underwater up to his neck, and he's doing his meditation, practicing and doing yoga, where he does this weird shit with his stomach. And it's cool when a guy like that exists, when there really is a bad motherfucker, like a real, like, mystical, sort of a shaman Brazilian jiu-jitsu master who's better than everybody else.
And that reminds me of the most surreal moment of my jiu-jitsu career, man, was at Abu Dhabi at the first weigh-in. Hickson comes up to me and says, hey, Hedy, how you doing? He shook my hand. My head almost exploded. I couldn't believe him saying Eddie.
Yeah.
Was very strange, dude. It was
that
strange.
He knew who you were. Yeah.
Now, because, you know, Kron and Jean-Jacques are real tight. Jean-Jacques is now a coral belt under Hickson Gracie. So Hickson Gracie is Jean-Jacques' master now. And he used to be Gracie Baja and under Carlinhos and all them. But now he's under Hickson. And Jean-Jacques always been tight with Crud. That's how he had that insight. That's how he knew he was going to be a champion, the champion that he is. So Jean-Jacques brought Crud over to my gym maybe 2 weeks ago, and that was the first time I ever got to hang out with Crud and train with him. And it was pretty amazing to have Hicks and Son there. And anytime I have a Gracie there with me that I could talk to, I always want to remind them that there's a big misconception about what 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu is all about. And to someone who really doesn't know and hasn't done the research, it's easy to kind of see that, easy to believe that I turned my back on jiu-jitsu once I got my black belt. I threw the gi away. I'm disrespectful to the gi.
Understands this if they don't follow jiu-jitsu, but there's two camps of jiu-jitsu. There's people who train with a gi, this, you know, big bulky kimono thing, and there's no gi, which is mostly guys wear rash guards or shorts, and they're training basically techniques that would work in mixed martial arts. Because of the fact that the gi is this big piece of cloth, people grab it and hold on to it, and it really changes the entire nature of grappling. It changes everything because you have all these handles that you can hold on to. It becomes really annoying.
Yeah, and a majority of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community, they really like the gi, and I understand that. It's like liking long boards and you're a surfer, and some people like short boards. No gi would be like the short board, and long board would be like the gi. It's really traditional. It looks cool. You grow up and you see these karate movies, and you want to wear that gi, and you strap that black belt on, and you got a gi. You feel like a superhero because that black belt is real. I get it. I understand. But I got into Jiu-Jitsu because of the UFC. I became a fanatic of the UFC, and jiu-jitsu is the closest thing I could do to be kind of close to the sport and understand the sport without getting hit in the face. I don't like boxing. I don't like kickboxing. I don't want to get hit, but jiu-jitsu is awesome. It's safe. You know, all you're doing is practicing strangling each other and getting really good at that and practicing breaking limbs. Like, who doesn't want to learn that? Anybody can learn that, and you don't get hurt. No one's punching you. I was sold right when I saw the UFC. It was a way for me to be close to the UFC, the sport that I worship now. So when I see jiu-jitsu black belts in the UFC, great with the gi, but all of a sudden they're fighting in the UFC without a gi, and now they don't have their handles, and dudes are trying to punch them, and there's elbows and all that stuff. To me, I thought the gi was the problem. Jiu-jitsu wasn't looking that good in the UFC, man, in those dark ages, like UFC 17 to, ooh, like that. Even today, overall, the jiu-jitsu, I think, could be a lot better if everyone focused on jiu-jitsu techniques that worked specifically when dudes are trying to punch you or elbow you, and, you know, and there's no handles. It's different. So anyways, I loved jiu-jitsu so much that I was tired of being in let down by never seeing, you rarely see sweeps in the UFC. You go to a jiu-jitsu class or a jiu-jitsu tournament where they're wearing a gi, you see sweeps and submissions off your back from the guard when you're on your back all the time. But why weren't you seeing it in the UFC? I go, you rarely see sweeps. And even today when you see a good quality sweep, it's a highlight reel. That was an amazing sweep. But in the gi, they happen all the time, and submissions off the back happen all the time. So the difference is, it's just common sense. In the gi, you don't have to worry about dudes elbowing you, and you got all these handles, and you develop all these techniques based on pulling the collar and holding on the sleeve, and that becomes your fighting stance.
Right.
And if that's your fighting stance, and all of a sudden you do MMA, and there's no fight, the fighting stance is totally different. You're clinching now because you don't want to get knocked out. You got to focus on that. So for me, I thought, man, if I ever opened up a school, I never liked the gi to begin with. Personally, I'd rather train no gi. It's faster. I like it faster. I have no problems with the gi. A lot of my students still train in the gi. Personally, it's just too slow for me. I need it to be faster. So when I have a lot of people in the jiu-jitsu community think that I turn my back on jiu-jitsu. Man, nothing could be further from the truth.
I don't think anybody really thinks so.
No, no.
There's just a bunch of haters out there. There's people that hate no matter what you do, man.
Yeah, but
there's no need to focus on them.
No, I just wanted to make it clear. And when Kron came to my school 2 weeks ago, I made it clear to him. I'm like, I just want to let you know that I have all the respect in the world for the Gracies. Anybody that thinks I don't is ridiculous. I mean, in my first book that came out in 2005, it opens up with a paragraph or two on each Gracie and thanking them for creating me and creating the sport and the UFC. So, and that's over. That's like 10 years ago. It's not anything that I'm trying to do damage control now or anything. So, I just wanted to put that out there that
you don't have to put that out there, yeah. Man. Nobody believes that. Hey, what'd you think about the UFC this weekend?
Incredible.
Was that the craziest UFC ever?
Yeah, it was going on right when Abu Dhabi was going on. It was going on at Saturday or Sunday morning. Was it Sunday morning? And it was Saturday morning here or something like that. It was like it was weird. So I didn't get to see it live. And I don't think it was possible to see it live. We ended up seeing it the next day. Amir and Scott Palmer, another one of my students who went, they figured out how to find it somewhere online.
Oh, so you watched it online?
Yeah, yeah.
The Diego Sanchez-Gilbert Melendez fight was the craziest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It was madness, especially that third round. God damn, that was incredible.
Yeah.
They just went off. They just went after it in a way like you very rarely see.
And for Diego to drop Gilbert Melendez with that uppercut after all that damage he was taking...
Yeah.
Man, there we saw some serious heart that night. I mean, Junior Dos Santos, that talk about heart.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, Diego Sanchez is a special dude. His belief in himself and his ability to absorb punishment.
Yeah,
it's craziness. He just bites down his mouthpiece, and he doesn't do a lot of slipping and moving. You know, he's taking a lot of them and just charging forward.
He loves it.
He's so crazy. He had a giant cut over his eye, man. It was bigger than his eyebrow.
Yeah.
It was like the size of his eyebrow. It was enormous.
Yeah.
There was a whole wild fucking event. Did you see Hector Lombard and Nate Marquardt?
Yes.
Holy shit.
At 170, Hector Lombard's going to give... He'll give anybody fits. I could see him...
He could be the champ.
Yeah, easily.
Easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's terrifying. At 170, he's a freak athlete, man.
Would GSP be able to take him down?
I don't know, man. I don't know. He's a freak athlete. Well, I use that term a lot, freak athlete, but Hector Lombard really is a freak. And at 170, that might be the strongest 170 that's ever existed ever. He hit so fucking hard. Dude, he chased down Nate Marquardt, who was a Strikeforce former champion, okay? Nate Marquardt was the Strikeforce welterweight champion. And Hector Lombard chased him around like he was some kid that he was going to assault. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, he like almost like he had no worry whatsoever about Nate Marquardt's techniques. Just ran after him, kept throwing bombs at him,
and that last shot
took him out.
That last shot, did you see what it did to Nate's body?
Yeah,
it made him kind of like hop and land on his butt, like his legs slipped out from under him because he was like kind of running away, and he got him one of those uppercuts from behind.
Yeah, yeah.
And then boom, it lifted him up and he landed right on his butt. It was pretty crazy.
It was horrific. Yeah, he fucked him up, man. It was spooky. I didn't know that he was going to be able to do that. I mean, I knew that Jake Ellenberger and Nate Marquardt had a real tough fight, and Nate got knocked out, but they were going after each other. You know, I mean, Nate was going after him too. He got caught with a big shot by Ellenberger, and Ellenberger could take anybody out, but it was competitive up until that. This was not competitive. This was a mugging. I mean, he just came after Nate Marquardt. Nate Marquardt tried to counter him a couple of times with right hands, but mostly he was just trying to get the fuck out of the way. And that dude just came at him like a monster. It was weird. He's ridiculously strong.
Yeah.
This is a scary dude at 170 pounds. I want immediately to see matches with him against like Carlos Condit. Yeah. Immediately to see him against guys like Johnny Hendricks or George St. Pierre, whoever wins the title.
According to Eric Paulson, I had him on my podcast. He's telling me some Hector Lombard stories. Man, the guy is intense 24/7. The guy in the gym wants to throw down. Him and Josh Barnett threw down at least once.
Yeah, Josh told me about
death.
It.
Josh, did he?
Josh mounted him and would never let him up. He was just beating on him. He wouldn't let him up. Because apparently he had an issue with something Lombard did to someone else in the gym. So Josh and him just went after it. Josh said the guy's a freak athlete. He said he does those muscle ups. You know those things where you do a chin up and then you push up from the top?
Yeah.
They're really hard to do.
Yeah.
This motherfucker he'd never done it before. He banged out like 10 in a row. Whoosh, boom, whoosh, boom, whoosh.
I don't think I'll ever be able to do one.
He's a freak athlete. Like when you look at his body, he's 5'7" and 5'7" wide. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he's so big. I mean, he's probably about 5'9". He's probably a little taller than me, you think? I don't know. My height or five, maybe either my height or maybe slightly taller. I'm 5'8", but he's twice as wide as me. I mean, he might, and I'm pretty wide. He might be like literally a foot wider than me.
Yeah, I think it's an illusion. He's actually, he might be 5'10", but his laps are so wide and his shoulders that it appears that he's 5'4". Or something.
He's so wide. I've never seen a dude his height that wide before. And the power that motherfucker has. God damn, it's scary. Scary. And just ultimate confidence in his ability to knock guys out. Ultimate confidence. Like, as he charged in on Nate, it was just, he knew it was a matter of time. It was weird. It was weird to watch. I never thought I'd watch Nate get steamrolled like that. You know, you think about Nate. Nate fought Anderson Silva, and it was a decent fight until Anderson reversed him on the ground and beat him up and stopped him. But it was a decent fight before that. Nate fought Tyron Woodley and knocked him out. I mean, Nate is a bad motherfucker. He's a really good fighter. You know, think of all the guys he's knocked out. He knocked out Martin Kampman. You know, Nate Marquardt's no fucking joke. He's been around a long-ass time, too. He's really fucking good.
Lombard's got that Hendrix power. Just yeah. Boom.
But he's got it in both hands.
Yeah.
He's just terrifying. Terrifying. Lombard's terrifying. He might be the motherfucker at 170, man. He really might be.
Yes, he might be.
So these guys, man, sometimes it's just a matter of making that weight. Getting down to the weight class. Yeah. Look at Damian Maia at 170. Yeah. You know? But then Jake Shields beat him, which is crazy.
That could have went either way.
Yeah, I think one of those fights that easily could be a draw. You could decide who wins, but yeah. Maia didn't tap him. You know, a lot of people were saying that Maia was going to dominate him the way he dominated Rick Story.
Yeah.
No. People forget how good a grappler Jake Shields is.
Yeah. He never really got close to any submissions. And Jake, he's probably top three, if not the best, passer in MMA.
Yeah.
His passing is incredible. Him and Sean Sherk, incredible passing. And Jake almost passed so many times. God. And to have that kind of confidence to try to pass Maya's guard, most wrestlers will just say, okay, in this fight you get on top, don't even try to pass. But Jake kept trying to pass. And even though he didn't quite make it, it was very impressive that he had the confidence to keep pushing and keep trying to pass. And Damian Maia really couldn't do anything off his back against Jake. Jake's used to having guys attack him, you know, serious guys off their back. So, man, that was a very, very close fight. I thought they would give it to Maia because it was in Brazil. I thought Jake's really going to have to beat him decisively to get it in Brazil. But that wasn't the case after all. So congratulations to Jake.
Yeah, that was a big win for him because Maia was on the verge of a title shot. After the Rick Story fight, after beating John Fitch, and then beat Rick Story like that, a lot of people were like, Jesus Christ, this guy might be the best grappler in the division. No one can stop him. So Jake wins that fight, derails his title hopes. There's just so many good fighters now, man. It's crazy. Robbie Lawler is about to fight Rory McDonald. How fucking crazy is that fight going to be?
Yeah, yeah.
Robbie Lawler at 170. There's another one at 170. It's fucking terrifying. He's absolutely terrifying at 170. Did you see Amagov and TJ Wahlberger?
Yeah.
Robbie Lawler knocked out Amagov with a flying knee. That's how scary Robbie Lawler is.
Yeah. I'll never forget Dana White at the Comedy Store years ago telling you about Robbie Lawler for the first time. He's like, I got this kid, Robbie Lawler, man. This guy can knock you out with both hands. I remember hearing that, and then he brought him up. He did well in the beginning, and then he started fighting for Strikeforce.
He was fighting at 85. He shouldn't have been fighting at 85.
Yeah.
He should have been fighting at 170 the whole time. But he also needed to mature, come into his own. You know, he's like 30 now. And now he's like a real legit professional. You know, he fights smart. He doesn't just wing punches at guys, but he does still wing punches at guys. He's got a serious fucking chin, and he goes after guys.
When is that fight?
That's November. That's the George St. Pierre undercard.
Damn.
Good googly moogly. Dude, Rory McDonald and think about that camp, that TriStar camp. Rory McDonald, GSP. You got so many good guys out of that camp, that Francis Carmon guy. But Robbie Lawler's a motherfucker. I don't know who's going to win that fight. Rory's like super technical, doesn't take too many chances, works on that long jab, you know. But Robbie Lawler will go after a motherfucker.
Yeah.
He's spooky.
Yeah. What'd you think of Roy Nelson Cormier?
Cormier's a fucking sick athlete, man. He's a sick athlete.
Is he for sure going to 205?
Yeah, he's going. He wants to fight John Jones.
Yeah, that's what he needs to be.
He's saying it. He was saying, I'm going to 205. Yeah, he'll be at 205. He was 224 for this fight. You know, he'll go down to 205, and he's going to be a handful for everybody.
Yeah.
He's that elite Olympic gold medalist caliber athlete. Those motherfuckers are rare dudes. You know, those dudes, they break their hand and keep punching you with it until it falls apart.
Yeah.
He was throwing punches at Josh Barnett with a broken hand. You know, he's taking Josh Barnett up in the air with a broken hand, slamming him on the ground with, you know, his fucking bones are rattling against themselves inside of his hand.
To do that to Josh Barnett, man.
Exactly. Jesus, that's what I said.
He's
got to
be out of this world.
And he's not even a legit heavyweight. He wrestled at 206. I think he wrestled at 206. It was definitely light because he had to cut weight to do it, and that's why he lost his bid at the Olympics, because he had kidney failure. Because he tried to make the weight. He tried to cut the weight, like cut a lot of weight, and he fucked himself up. A lot of guys have that, man. You know, Jose Aldo has kidney stones now. He had a kidney stone removed after his fight with the Korean Zombie. That's from cutting weight.
Yeah, one of my students had kidney stones, and since he went to the hospital and went through all the excruciating pain and me hearing the stories, he said, bro, drink cranberry juice, pure cranberry juice. Don't drink that cocktail every day. You do not want to go through what I just went through. I swear to God, I have pure cranberry juice in my refrigerator. I make sure my wife keeps it stocked and I drink it every day. Just hearing his story of excruciating pain in the hospital. Ugh.
Does this guy, who is it? Which guy?
I don't know. I don't want to say his name.
Okay. Does he cut weight?
Yes, he cuts massive weight. That's shredded. Good, yeah. Yeah. He's shredded.
It's these dudes that cut weight to do matches.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. That shit's bad for you.
Yeah.
Cutting weight is not good. But if you want to be a great fighter.
Yeah, just drink pure cranberry juice, not the cocktail, and you should be fine every day.
Probably tastes like shit. It
tastes sour, but it's like a shot. I drink it every day.
Where do you get it? Do you make it?
Whole Foods. You can get it at anywhere, any supermarket.
And it's have cranberry pills that does the same thing.
Does it do the same thing?
Just take a shot of cranberry
juice.
How
could it do the same thing, though? It never does. You know, like you take those like pills, green pills. They're never as good as like real wheatgrass juice.
Just drink the juice. It's kind of sour, but you get used to it.
It's actually not bad.
Yeah. And you can't drink that much of it, so it's perfect. It's like a way to quench your thirst, and you're not going to down like half the bottle. If it was grape drink or something, shit, you'd kill half the bottle. But since it's so tart, you're forced to only take a sip.
And so that, what does that do? What's in it that protects your dick?
It's got to be the acid in it, because it's kind of sour. It's got to be, has something to do with that and making sure that those stones are always broken down. It probably just melts them or something. I don't know.
I used to date this girl who used to get urinary tract infections. And she used to have to drink cranberry juice to get rid of it.
Yeah.
How weird is that?
Cranberry juice is legit.
It's weird that there's foods, though, that cure things. You know, like you have any stomach ailments, anything bothering your stomach, take garlic. It's incredible. Like if you eat some bad food and get some sort of stomach, like food poisoning, shit like that, eat some cloves of garlic.
Yeah.
It's like sending in rabid Italian troops that go down in there and just fuck up all the bacteria. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And people who don't like raw garlic, you don't know what you're missing. Just eat cloves of that shit. It's fantastic for you.
Yeah.
It's like an assault on all the shitty things inside your body.
How about that Tony Ferguson Mars?
Damn. Why is he called a Mars?
Well, because you got to name every move and every position and every transition, in my opinion, in order to teach at the highest level. So there's a difference between getting a Dars when you're on top and you're using your weight.
Right.
He wasn't on top. He cinched it in and went to his back. And Mark Lehman, he's a very well-known MMA jiu-jitsu coach. He used to do that. He's the one who actually called it the Dars when it was named after the first guy he saw use it, Joe Dars, and I think his name is DRC.
Yeah,
and that's who Mark Lehman is very similar to me, as we like to name everything that doesn't have names, and lots of jiu-jitsu moves didn't. So you got to name there's a difference between the Mars, because the Mars is on your back, and that's how he used to do it. He said that was his thing, that he did, his squeeze was so tight that he didn't need to be on top, and he liked rolling guys and they didn't expect it, and so he called it the Mars. There's also a farce, which I don't know if a guy named Freddie made it up. I don't know the story behind farce, but that's when you're kind of mounting the guy and you are mounting the guy and you have a Dars. So there's a different variations of it, and the one that Tony trains at 10th Planet Costa Mesa all week, and every Thursday he comes up and trains with me, and that's the move you got to watch when you're rolling with Tony. He does flying darces, man. His jiu-jitsu is very underrated, man. He's going to shock a lot of people over his career.
Well, that darce that he hit that dude with, he immediately scooted under him, and then almost like an inverted crucifix, he ties his arm up with his legs from the bottom as
he
does it. You
got to have confidence in your squeeze to do that, man.
Yeah.
You know, so that tells you a lot. You're like, wow, you don't ever see anybody going to the Mars. You see people going to the Darce, and if the guy on the bottom rolls, you should be able to roll with him. Even if it turns into a Mars, still finish it. But you don't go there voluntarily unless you're super confident with that move.
Having those long arms is such a massive advantage. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. As far as like that leverage that you can get with long limbs,
yeah,
it's really incredible. Guys who have like wicked darces and have long arms, they can just like shove them under plate. Like Kendall Grove. Yep. Kendall Grove used to catch them in all sorts of weird spots because he had an extra foot on his arms.
Yep. Jeff Glover as well. Yep. He's one of the best at darces.
Yeah. Jeff Glover lets you pass him. I love that move where he lets you get into side control and you think you're going into side control, but really you're just going into darce land.
Yeah.
He just catches it in the transition.
Yeah.
It's jiu-jitsu, for people who don't know, it's so fucking technical. There's so many techniques. I mean, it's truly amazing when you stop and consider the positions, the amount of different possibilities each position holds, and then different ways to submit people and how they all flow together. If you've never done it before, it's hard to kind of understand it, and I know that's one of the things that I take a lot of time on when it comes to a ground battle in the UFC. I always make sure I try to explain what a guy's trying to do, where it becomes a problem, where he's going to, and people get a chance to see it more that way, but unless you train yourself, you'll never really truly understand the beauty of it. If you train yourself, you'll get a sense of what it's like to struggle to actually catch a guy in a position. Then you'll understand how amazing it is when you see like really, really high level stuff. When you see a mad scramble like Cron Gracie and Gary Tonin and Gary taking Cron's back in that wild scramble.
Yeah.
You know, they kept rolling, kept rolling, kept rolling, then bam, locks up the body triangle. Like, fuck.
Yeah, yeah. It's an art that anybody can do. Children, old ladies, they all do it. It's really, really easy. I'm not trying to sell it to obviously I want to make money, but it's the truth. The truth is anybody can learn it. All you have to do is just show up to your local jiu-jitsu school and just watch. Just go and just watch for a couple times. It's free. You don't have to commit to it. Just tell the guy you want to watch, and you watch and you realize, oh my God, I had it all wrong. You know, you expect that you're going to show up and there's going to be all these fucking douchebags killing each other and bleeding on each other. And you realize it's a bunch of nerds. It's a bunch of computer nerds. And after you watch one class, you should be sold on it. And you don't have to roll and do, you know, people are scared of rolling and, oh, what if he taps me out and hurts me? It's so rare that anybody gets hurt, really. It's so rare.
You usually get hurt more from positions than you do from submissions.
Yeah.
You get hurt more when your leg gets tripped onto you. But, you know, as you get better at it, that becomes less and less. And as you, if you're in a good school like 10th Planet or like, there's so many good schools in L.A. and we get spoiled. But most places have to be good in order to stay open in this day and age because there's so much competition. There's amazing amounts of competition.
Yeah.
From jiu-jitsu.
Our beginning classes are, we kind of changed them up a little. Over the years, I realized that most people are a lot more scared of going to a jiu-jitsu class and checking it out and taking one class than I thought.
Mm.
They're way more scared than I thought. So I understand that. I used to think that, you know, if you should know that it's a safe sport and you should know if you want to do it or not. And if you're not totally into it, I don't want to talk you into it. You should just know. And then that leaves me with a small percentage of the population, which I consider, oh, you're my family. But in reality, if I change my beginner classes and make them cater more to the guys that want to do it, but they're just scared to death. They're scared to death of signing a contract. They're scared to death of getting hurt. They're coming into jiu-jitsu scared. So you got to really think about just walking them through it nice and slowly, showing them that there's nothing to be scared of. This is a beautiful thing that everyone can learn. You can learn to get really good at putting people to sleep in 6 months.
You know, another thing is don't be afraid to tap. That's another thing that I make sure I really tell people. It's nothing wrong with tapping. It's not that bad. Just go in there and tap. It's you got to think about it like someone scoring a point on you in basketball. It's going to happen. It's totally normal.
Yeah.
And once you get past that, especially if you're training with good people, you tap them, they tap you, doesn't matter. It's good for you. Yeah. And if you can't tap a guy but he can tap you, guess what? That's good for you too. It's good for you to know that someone can tap you. You need to up your game and up your skill level to get to the point where he's at. But just because he taps you, it's no big deal. It doesn't matter. People tap people all the time.
That's one of the biggest reasons people are afraid to come in. They're afraid to lose this game of death, because really that's why jiu-jitsu is so fascinating and such a beautiful thing, because really it applies to life in on the streets, saving your family, protecting your children, protecting your wife protecting your children, and back and forth, your children knowing jiu-jitsu and protecting their father and son, you know, whole family where everyone does jiu-jitsu. That's, you know, that increases your chances of survival in like some apocalyptic era or whatever.
Well, either way, it's a great way to exercise. It's a great discipline. Yeah. It's great for your body. It's great for your mind. Like, after we leave jiu-jitsu class, tell me, when are we more like loose, relaxed, and silly than after jiu-jitsu meals?
Yeah. Oh,
like, dude, we've had hilarious after jiu-jitsu conversations where everybody's exhausted. You've been fighting for your life for the past hour and a half, and we're all just hanging out, chilling, and tried to kill each other just an hour before.
It's like a virtual reality video game.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get used to that. It becomes a normal thing. For folks where it's not a normal thing, it seems daunting, it seems terrifying, it seems uninviting. But believe me, I know a lot of, like you said, nerds. And it's a lot of nice people in jiu-jitsu too. People who have a good control of their ego. We've talked about that on this podcast many times, but I think it needs repeating. It's
absolutely. I can't tell you how many tweets, emails, messages, how many I get. I listen to you guys talk about jiu-jitsu on the podcast over and over, and then I finally went to a school and I tried it, and guess what? You were right. This is amazing. This is changing my life. My son's doing it now too. It's and that is the most likely outcome. If you give it a shot and you have an open mind and leave your ego at the door, is it's going to change your life for the
better. It's going to give you, without a doubt, it's going to be one of the best vehicles for developing your confidence that you can ever find. It will change your confidence.
Yeah.
And that's women, including women. You know, like, think about women that you know that have gone to your schools, gone to different jiu-jitsu classes and gotten better at it. And then they become like more relaxed person. They become a different person.
Yeah.
They're not worried about their self-defense around men anymore. They know that the reality is a girl is a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. Like, do you remember when we had Felicia do that thing with Seymour Butts?
Yes. Explain that.
Seymour Butts is a nice guy. He's a porn star and a porn producer, and he had a show.
On Showtime.
I don't remember what the name of it was. Do you remember the show?
Maybe it was just Seymour Butts.
I don't remember what it was. But anyway, real nice guy. In one of the episodes, he wanted to come down and do jiu-jitsu with a woman.
No. He just wanted to come down and do jiu-jitsu.
Oh, really?
It was not with a woman.
He didn't want to do it with Felicia? Did you set that up on purpose?
I set that up on purpose. He had Felicia, no idea.
Felicia O, who's a friend of ours, she's a black belt under Jean-Jacques Machado and a legit bona fide badass. She's like 135 pounds. She's not a big woman, but she is strong as fuck, and her jiu-jitsu is top-notch. And she's really smart. She's super, super, super smart. So she just gets good at anything. She just knows how to get good at shit. And her and Seymour Butts rolled. It was like his first day. And she manhandled this poor lad.
He didn't get hurt. He just tapped. He lost the game over and over.
She was so nice.
Which never feels amazing. When you tap out, it doesn't feel refreshing.
No.
And that's why it's so beautiful, because it didn't feel good. You just lost a game of death. No one got hurt, but that tap represented the fact that he had your life in his hands. And the only reason he let go is because he's a cool guy and everyone's cool in class. But in reality, if he was a douchebag and he wanted to kill you, he could have.
Yeah, they take your life. If someone wanted to choke you out and then stomp your head out while you're unconscious, that's what happens. But the point is, Felicia, being this small woman, just using her technique, just tapped him over and over and over again. Got him in a triangle, got his back, got him in an arm bar. And the way she did it was so fluid and beautiful.
And you watch the episode, it doesn't... I don't think it goes down like that. They edited it to make him look good because we shot a segment where I'm teaching and then I'm teaching him and we're doing the teaching segment. And then I asked him, do you want to roll too? Cause he didn't even know what like rolling. I go, do right. We kind of spar. And he said, yeah, yeah, we'll shoot that and we'll do that. And I go, well, we'll spar with the woman, you know, and make it. And he's like, okay, whatever.
That was your idea. That's so funny. It was so long ago. I forgot.
Yeah. Generally, if you're a girl out there and you do jiu-jitsu for 1 year solid, the chances of you getting raped go down significantly. It's very hard to rape a jiu-jitsu girl. And it doesn't take that long to get good at it. Like I said, within 2 years, time flies. You could be doing it 3 years just like that, and you're a badass.
The last time I rolled with Felicia, I think I was a purple belt. I might have been a brown belt. But it was either purple or brown belt. And it's not like I was like trying to kill her, but I didn't tap her. She was 135 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, and she's just fucking good, man.
Really strong.
She's really strong and she's fucking good. Yeah. And when someone's really good, they know how to put themselves in the perfect position. They know how to keep moving. They know how to keep getting away from anything that you're trying to do to them and putting themselves in a better position to defend, a better position to attack. That being many steps ahead of the person you're doing it with because they don't know what you're doing, give someone a massive amount of confidence. And I've seen girls go into jiu-jitsu class, start getting good, and then start tapping out guys. And when they start tapping out guys, it's a wild thing to watch. It's a wild thing to see the guy's face. It's a wild thing to see a girl like cinch up. First girl I ever saw tap a dude out was this girl Duncan used to roll with. they were both beginners. And do you remember we got Duncan and Ari, gave him a free year for like Christmas? Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah. I do. Very well.
Ari stuck it out. Yeah. Ari got some taps in on some dudes. Yeah. He kept going. But Duncan ran into this girl who was very pretty and very girly, but she tapped him with the quickness. Like, how many times did she tap him? She tapped him like several.
Man.
It was ugly.
Yeah.
But it was fascinating to watch, like this girl realizing like she could, if she knew the techniques better, she could get a guy. A guy's probably stronger than her. She could still get him.
That scarred Duncan, he never, he didn't laugh. I think he showed up to maybe a handful of classes at most. Ari stuck it out for a while.
Yeah.
But with Ari, he got hurt. He something happened to his knee. I think he
got
had surgery.
Staff, and then he had a meniscus surgery, and then he got staff.
Yeah.
And that was too much. He couldn't take it.
Some people, there's a small percentage of people that get hurt doing jiu-jitsu, and that scares them, and they never want to come back. But generally, most of the people who do jiu-jitsu love it so much that the first thing they think of when they get hurt, they're pissed off because they're going to be out for 6 weeks, or they're going to be out for 3 months. That's why they're pissed. They can't wait to get back, and you can't wait to get back so much that you're like, a lot of times you come back too early, and you're not really healed right, and then you re-injure yourself. So that's that. Generally, if you come in with an open mind and you leave your ego at the door, generally you're going to fall in love with it. It's going to change your life. And when you get hurt, you're more bummed about missing jiu-jitsu than you are about the actual injury. You know, but there are some people that they get ringworm once and they're like, fuck this. You get ringworm. And accept ringworm. You know, it's very easy to eliminate ringworm. You never have to deal with it if you can be consistent with the yogurt and the acidophilus.
And defense soap.
Yeah.
Get some defense soap.
Absolutely.
Tell everybody.
Yeah. Defense soap is the best.
And it's a great company owned by a great guy.
Yeah.
And the company, they support wrestlers and they develop soap that cleans your skin without fucking up all the natural bacteria.
Yeah.
Though the healthy flora.
I was resistant to defense soap for a while. I never really looked into it in the very beginning. I thought it was a soap that had all these
antibiotics or something.
Yeah, antibiotics and chemicals that I didn't want to have nothing to do with it. It just sounded like that. But when I finally looked into it and found out that it was just eucalyptus oil and
tea tree oil.
Yeah. In high amounts. It's like three times the amount that you find in
I bring that everywhere.
Yeah.
I bring it on the road with me. I don't go to a hotel room unless I have that shit with me.
I use defense soap every day. Yeah. Every day.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, once I found out it was all natural and I was sold.
Now that I don't need shampoo anymore, I use it on the top of my head too. I use it everywhere.
I use it as shampoo.
Damn, you crazy. Yeah. You crazy Eddie Bravo.
It keeps dandruff away because dandruff is a form of fungus similar to ringworm.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, healthy skin flora is something that people don't even think about, but You know, I mean, that's what killed a lot of motherfuckers back in the day when people got scratched and, you know, they got some sort of infection and, you know, they people used to die of infections all the time. That's like one of the biggest deaths, the biggest scary things about going to a hospital today is infections, you know, and you can do a little bit to prevent that stuff by a healthy diet, eating a lot of probiotics. Even if you're a vegan, say if you only eat vegetables, you can still get probiotics in the form of sauerkraut. Sauerkraut, like natural raw sauerkraut, super good for you.
Vegans,
kombucha, super good for you.
Vegans can have acidophilus pills?
Well, see, they shouldn't even really have kombucha because kombucha is a fungus, and a fungus is actually closer to a person than a plant is. Funguses are actually closer to human beings than plants are. Funguses are actually much more like an animal than they are like a plant. So if you're a true vegan and you're eating kombucha, you're kind of a hypocrite. If you eat mushrooms, you're kind of a hypocrite, too.
Jell-O, also.
But, they actually probably want you to eat them. And that's the whole idea behind psilocybin, is that psilocybin wants you to eat it. That's why it's big and white and gigantic. It shows up. Like, it shows itself very easily on cow patties and shit like that. Like, it's literally, like, inviting you to come and eat it. Because that's how
it
communicates
with you. The red tops with the white?
Yeah. I mean, come on. How beautiful
the red ones, right?
Yeah, how beautiful. That's the Amanita muscaria. But psilocybin, the ones that grow on cow shit, they have, you know, the big giant ones in the Amazon. They grow the size of dinner plates.
What's the difference? They both get you to that other dimension?
Amanita muscaria is a very controversial mushroom. And for folks who never heard of the Amanita muscaria
that's
mushroom.
The red one that you
the
see.
Red one with the white spots. It's literally Santa Claus.
Okay.
And I'll break it down real quick for people who have never heard this before. Go to my look up Google Joe Rogan, Santa Claus was a mushroom. I wrote a whole article about it in like 2006 or something like
I'm
that.
I'm talking about the difference
my website.
In what it
well,
does
I'm about to
you.
Explain. I'm about to explain to people.
Okay.
The Amanita muscaria mushroom is native to Siberia, to Europe. It's a different mushroom. The mushroom, the psilocybin mushroom that you see in tropical climates and we see in a lot of places now. The Pacific Northwest has a lot of them. It's that's a different experience, and that's a much more accessible experience, and it's a much more reliable experience. The Amanita muscaria oftentimes isn't even psychoactive. Like, they don't know what makes it psychoactive and what doesn't. There's all sorts of speculation that it could be genetically variable. It could be seasonally variable. It could be, you know, there's strains of it that grew in certain areas, and they were super potent, but they don't exist anymore, or you have to find them. I've never had a good Amanita muscaria trip. I only had one to speak of that was that really blew it out, but we took psilocybin too. We took the Amanita for like an hour and it wasn't doing shit.
Is that us?
No, it was me and Stanhope. Me, Stanhope, and Jan Irvin.
How many grams?
He made this weird soup. He made like a tea with the Amanita muscaria. Like, he knows how to do all that shit. Jan is pretty well versed in how to prepare these things.
There was a specific amount that Terrence McKenna talked about, 5 grams.
Yeah, five. Well, that's psilocybin. This is the Amanita muscaria, like I was saying.
Okay.
So we took that, and then an hour or so in, we decided to jump it with psilocybin. And then when we jumped it with psilocybin, wow, the two of them together, it was pretty fucking intense. And it was the day of the war. So it was really, really, really weird. And we had this Mata de Coco tea. It's cocaine tea. It's tea that's derived from coca leaves, like natural coca leaves. This is more shit that Jan
is
had.
Is it legal?
I don't believe so. I would say nay. But it should be, because the actual leaves themselves in these indigenous high-altitude herding populations, they just chew them. They chew them all day, and it's like tobacco to them or like anything else that people normally have. It's like, you know, like chewing gum or something like that. And it provides like it's a clean stimulant. It's when you break it down and turn it into cocaine that it becomes like a real fucking pain in the ass.
Yeah.
It becomes addictive, and you know people get weirded out on it. But they say it's actually better for you than coffee if you just chew the leaves.
I just found out within the last year. I saw a documentary on where ecstasy comes from. The ingredient MDMA, right?
Yeah.
It comes from these trees in Thailand and Cambodia.
Yeah.
So they're like chopping down all these trees to get like the inner core of it, and that's what makes ecstasy. How crazy is that? I thought it was like a pure lab created thing.
I did too. I think there was a Vice documentary on it. Another fucking Vice one. Those Vice guys are on top of everything.
Maybe that's the one I saw.
Probably. Yes. But it was fascinating.
It's crazy. It all comes from Cambodia and Thailand.
And there's a lot of violence associated with where these trees are now because people are killing people to try to get to these trees.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I wonder how that would be like taking it naturally, like right from the tree.
I know, right? Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could.
Crazy. He's trip to Thailand. Let's go find
place.
The trees. That's a movie. A group of guys that go find the tree with like three hot chicks. All the chicks die, of course, within the first 45 minutes. Or one survives. Only one at the end.
Ecstasy's a funny one, man. That's a really funny one. It's a really interesting one because it's thought of as like a party drug, and it certainly is, but you can learn a lot on ecstasy, man. I've only done it once, but I learned a lot. I had a very beneficial trip. I paid the price with my mental health for the couple days afterwards. I was wrecked.
Yeah.
Like my brain was not working well.
The come down is terrible.
For me, it was. For some people, apparently it's not. Or if you take 5-HTP, supposedly if you you down 5-HTP.
New mood?
That's 5-HTP as well. New mood
seems like it was specifically created for the partier.
It used to be roll on and roll off.
Remember?
Do you remember? And then, are you joking around? Are you serious?
You don't remember that?
You don't remember?
I don't remember roll on.
When Aubrey created it, the original thing was Aubrey likes to party, and he created it for the come down off of ecstasy. Because 5-HTP...
And that's what New Mood became, right?
Sort of. It was enhanced, and now New Mood has a bunch of different shit in it, like L-tryptophan, which converts to 5-HTP, so it has like a time release effect.
It's better.
Yeah. Well, it's better in that there's more than one mechanism for converting 5-HTP to serotonin. The L-tryptophan converts to 5-HTP, which converts to serotonin. It gives you the building blocks to replenish your serotonin surprise after you do something like that. But also gives you the extra serotonin throughout your day, which picks your mood up. So much so, man, that they say for people who are taking SSRIs or antidepressants, they tell them not to take 5-HTP. Because Neil Brennan, you know Neil Brennan, the dude we met from the Chappelle show? He was on 5-HTP, but he was also taking an antidepressant. The doctor told him to lay off the 5-HTP because it would give him too much serotonin.
Huh.
Yeah.
So that's for real.
Oh, it's definitely for real. Yeah. Have you tried any of that shit?
Well, I will say this. Depeche Mode was just in town last month, and after the Depeche Mode concert, I did take some New Mood. Took about four of them.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying without saying it.
What are you talking about?
You know what you should have done?
New Mood.
You should have taken Alpha Brain before the Depeche Mode concert, and you would have been smart enough to not go.
You can
Oh, no, I didn't. Shapow.
Hey.
Sold out the Staples Center three nights in a row. Come on. They haven't had a hit single in 10 years.
I'm joking.
That's like Pink Floyd status.
Old friend of ours, I think you were friends with him. I was friends with him. He used to work at the Comedy Store. I was murdered last night. I don't know if you remember Katie.
What?
He used to work there at the Comedy Store, and he recently moved to Las Vegas. And what happened is this gunman came into a nightclub, I believe it's at the Palms, and shot two guys. And then he was just supposedly a guy that was at this club, and he tried to tackle the guy because the guy was pointing his gun to like innocent people. So he was like doing a hero thing, and then he got shot. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember
Katie.
He was one of the nicest guys.
Man. Oh, that's horrible.
He was dating Katie?
No, no, his name was Katie.
His name's
KD.
Oh, remember Katie?
Yeah. We talked about Katie yesterday on the podcast. How hilarious she was. Yeah.
It makes sense.
But KD was one of my first friends in Los Angeles when I first moved here.
That's terrible. Yeah. Fuck, man. There was another school shooting the other day, too. Did you hear about that shit?
Yeah.
Real quick, before we get to the school shooting, back to the mushroom thing.
Yeah.
I'm reading...
We didn't even describe the difference.
Yeah. I'm reading a baby book, and this is back to mushrooms. And I've never read so many goddamn books in my life over the last 6 months. My kid, that's his favorite shit, is to have... He goes, grabs a book. We have 1,000 books. He grabs his favorite one. He sits on my lap and I read it. He loves that. And he knows what the last page is, and he'll flip it over. Start it over, son. Right. Start it over. And there's this one book about Nicholas the Bunny, and he's talking about how in the fall I like to watch the leaves. And in the winter, I find shelter from the rain under a toadstool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mushroom. I never heard mushrooms called toadstools before.
Yeah,
why is it? And then on the other side, there's a mushroom with a toad actually sitting on top of the mushroom. Right?
Yeah, they've been called toadstools forever. But they also, if you look up any old school Christmas shit,
yeah,
all old school Christmas cards, anything with elves, they all have mushrooms around them. And they have that mushroom, the Amanita muscaria mushroom.
Isn't there a myth that if you lick a frog's ass, you get high?
No, it's not a myth at all.
It's real?
Some frogs. Okay. Some frogs, it's different, though. Yeah. What they have is 5-MeO-DMT in them.
But what I'm saying is, I open up this baby book. There's a little bunny, Nicholas the Bunny, hiding under a toadstool. And then they show a mushroom and a frog on top of it, sitting down on it. So maybe that's why... when you lick a frog's ass, you get high because they actually sit on mushrooms.
No,
they're using the mushroom
to actually extracts from.
Listen, you don't lick a frog's ass. You don't lick a frog to get high. The way this doesn't work.
Okay,
it's an excretion. Yeah, this is what it is. This is an excretion from certain types of frog skin.
Okay.
And you have to rub it on glass. So you take this frog and you rub them on glass and they'll excrete their substance on the grass. Then you take that glass, you put it in the sun, it dries out. Then you take a razor blade and you scrape it off the glass and it's a white powder. You smoke that white powder and it's 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine.
Now, is that secretion coming from their rectum?
It's coming from their skin.
Okay.
It's that whole thing of licking a frog is just one of those urban myths.
Okay. It's just weird that in a baby book you hear about the myth of licking frog's ass and they're sitting on maybe cuz you know you some people put ecstasy pills in their ass for better absorption. You heard of that, Brian,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So maybe the frog is trying to get high and maybe they figured out how to get high by sitting on a mushroom. It goes up their ass. And they get high, and then you lick a frog's ass, and you get high. That's all I'm saying. This was in a baby book.
This is the name of the frog. It's called the Bufo aureus.
And you can't get fucked up, Joe, by licking it. If I remember correctly, it's super concentrated and super dangerous, though, to do it.
To lick it?
To lick it, because it's really concentrated.
If you remember...
Because I bought the
yeah, but you got to Google shit like that.
I bought
if you don't
the
know.
Frog to do this.
The book's called I Am a Bunny.
You bought a Bufo alvarius?
Yeah.
It's called the Colorado River Toad or Sonoran Desert Toad. It contains 5-MeO-DMT and Bufotenin, Bufotenin.
There's a website that sold these frogs, and so I bought one, and I had it for like a month, and I was like, no, I'm not doing it.
Was it alive?
Yeah.
So you never licked it?
No. I don't even know whatever I did with it.
I think it's a myth. If you had it, why didn't you lick it?
I mean, I don't know. I was too scared.
Can you Google licking a frog's ass?
Yeah, I'm doing that right now. I just did.
The toad's venom is concentrated on the surface of its skin, and that's why licking is dangerous. Smoking is a different story, however.
Yeah.
So it's too powerful if you lick it.
Too powerful if you lick it. Wow. Because it's concentrated.
The toxic ingredient in the toad's venom is called bufotenin, which is burned off while smoking. That's why it's dangerous. Because the two things are in it. If you burn it off... What's left is 5-MeO-DMT. So you don't want to lick it because if you lick it, it gives you bufotenin. Bufotenin gets burned off while you smoke it. That's why it's dangerous to lick it. Yeah. So I guess it really
does it say anything about the butthole?
So listen to this. This is what's weird. It's this frog. They're native to the Colorado River or southern Arizona, California, and northern New Mexico. Even though 5-MeO-DMT is classified as an unscheduled substance, which means it's legal to possess. But the venom also contains bufotenin, which is scheduled. So you can be in possession of an illegal substance, even though it's not a psychedelic. The weird thing about 5-MeO is it's stronger than N,N-DMT. N,N-DMT is the one that gives you the crazy visuals. But the stuff that we did the first time, that's 5-MeO. It's even stronger than NN, and it's legal.
The one where I was screaming?
Yeah. They missed that one. In the sweeping Psychedelic Drug Act of 1970, they missed 5-MeO-DMT.
This is what I had bought, a Colorado River toad.
Yeah, that's the motherfucker. Yep. Good thing you didn't lick it, dummy. Because you wouldn't have Googled it. You would have just, oh, let's just try.
I didn't have Google back then, I don't think. I think this is it was right before I moved here to Los Angeles.
Well, anybody listening, please don't lick the toad because you can die.
And don't lick poisonous dirt frogs.
Yeah, but if you take that stuff and you smoke it, it's DMT. You will trip your fucking balls off if you smoke the shit that comes from that toad's skin, which is really kind of crazy. The difference between that and psilocybin is very similar. Psilocybin also is N,N-dimethyltryptamine. It's got that and something else. So a psilocybin is like 4-fox-4-aloxy and dimethyltryptamine. So the last part of it is dimethyltryptamine. Then 5-MeO-dimethyltryptamine, which is what these frogs have, is dimethyltryptamine with like an oxygen molecule attached to it. So it has a different impact. But all that shit that's like prevalent in children's books and folklore, like all those elves, when you see, look at this guy's
name is Toad, and he has a mushroom head.
Yeah, and he has the head of the mushroom. Dude, that's Santa Claus.
Dude, I'm telling you, I think that's the people that are making books for kids.
Oh, absolutely.
You gotta kind of have had a mushroom trip to really want to help kids, you know, and it's kind of like... Like,
oh, that's crazy.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of mushrooms.
A lot of people want to help kids. They don't have to trip on mushrooms.
I don't know, but I swear to God, I watch a lot of educational TV for children, and they bring up mushrooms a lot. What is this? It's a mushroom, and it's a red mushroom. And it's like, why? There's so many other things you could have brought up. You're talking about mushrooms. You're trying to teach. Mushrooms come up a lot in children's books and in their TV. I don't know what it means.
Mario Brothers.
Well, think about Lewis Carroll and think about Alice in Wonderland. That was all about acid.
Yeah. Right now, there's billboards everywhere all over L.A. There's a new show called Wonderland or something, and there's a guy and a girl. They're looking at each other's eyes. In the background, all these mushrooms, red-topped, like those.
Amanita muscaria. Yeah, those mushrooms are what they believe to be Santa Claus, because it even looks like Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Those mushrooms also, this is where it gets really crazy if you haven't heard the whole spiel before. They have a symbiotic relationship with carnivorous trees, like pine trees. They grow under pine trees. They have a mycorrhizal relationship with the soil. Like those trees, that's where those things always grow. They feed off of each other. So this fucking thing is always underneath these trees, just like brightly colored gifts that are always underneath Christmas trees. Yeah. Why are Christmas trees always pine trees? Why do Christmas trees have these ornaments hanging in them?
You know,
because they used to take these mushrooms, they used to pull them out of the bottom of these trees and then hang them in the tree to dry them out. The other way they dried them out was they would hang them in front of fireplaces. That's why socks are white and red. Christmas socks are white and red. Who the fuck has white and red socks? Yeah. Nobody. Why would you hang your socks in front of the fireplace like that? Because that's how they dried out mushrooms. They used to tie them to strings and dangle in front of the fire, and that's how they dried them out. That's how they preserved them. Everything about it has to do with shamans, and everything about it has a connection to this mushroom. And that mushroom was like synonymous. The Amanita muscaria mushroom was synonymous with reindeers, because reindeer love those fucking things. Reindeer are caribou. Caribou live in Siberia. That's where they live up there. And these motherfuckers, when you're in like a shaman's hut and they're all like eating Amanita muscaria mushrooms and having these tribal ceremonies, they would go outside to piss, and the caribou would literally knock them over to get to their piss, because their piss had Amanita muscaria smell to it.
Damn, Hamilton Morrison did it on Vice.
Of course he did.
And
he's done everything.
Did mushrooms?
Yeah, this is
on the show.
You puke a lot.
This is the Amanita.
Yeah, there's part 1, 2, and 3 on.
He's done the frog, too. Well, there's another type of frog. If he shows a scar, there's a different thing. There's another type of frog where you take the venom of the frog and you cut yourself, and you take this toad's venom and you put it like directly into your skin. And somehow or another, by doing it, I think they burn themselves like with ash, like an ember, and then they put the frog, like, so it opens up the pores, and they put the frog's venom right into them, and they have this transcendent experience. Is that Hamilton Morris?
Yeah.
My stomach is in excruciating pain.
He's such a freak. In the exchange of I love this guy.
Is that a frog?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, see, they burn you, and then they stick this shit in on you. And you trip your balls off if you go meet with the spirit world. But, you know, there's people throughout history have come up with a bunch of different methods to transcend normal reality, normal consciousness. And in different parts of the world, when they were stuck in some area that didn't have mushrooms, they figured out what Datura does. They figured out what does this cactus do if you light it on fire? Yeah. You know, what is this bush? What's in this bush? People have been finding that stuff forever.
Yeah,
these scholars in Jerusalem think that that was what Moses was seeing when he went to the burning bush. He saw the burning bush that was God. It gave him the Ten Commandments. They believe that was DMT, because the bushes that they have, like the acacia bush, very rich in DMT. It's all over that area. bush burning, DMT, light DMT on fire, get high. It's like, it's so obvious.
The crazy experience I had with mushrooms was back in 2008. I did 5 grams, specifically 5 grams, weighed it, put it in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and went to the zoo. And that was a bad choice.
Yeah, you
bad decision.
Got fucked up.
It was a bad decision. I thought, hey, we'd be with animals and it'd be all about love. We get there. I went with the chick, and while we were checking out the gorillas is when it hit, and all we wanted to do is just sit in the shade, not look at the animals, close our eyes, and the visuals you get are just amazing. When people say, oh, that's in your head, you made that up. I'm like, there's no way. If I made that up, it would be fragmented and all fucked up. There's no way. As soon as I close my eyes, there's a show waiting for me, and it's there's in my opinion, there's no way I'm doing this. If I was running the show, it would not look like that. I don't have the ability, but
well, that's the actual what they believe is that what you're doing is you're hijacking your visual cortex, and so that these chemicals impact your visual cortex and create this incredible display because your body does not know how to process what's coming in. That's the idea behind it. But yeah. It doesn't. What I've always said is it doesn't matter because whether you're creating it, whether it's real or not real, it's still the same experience.
Yeah.
Whether it's real or not real, what is real? When it breaks down to it, you're actually seeing that.
Yeah.
So whether or not that's your imagination that's creating it, that's how people like to dismiss things. Oh, it's just in your imagination. No, it's not, and it doesn't matter even if it is because it's still the same thing. It's still this insane, crazy thing that you're looking at.
Yeah.
So even if it is your imagination, it's still the wildest fucking thing you're ever going to see in your life.
So hard to explain. The only way I could explain it is like, it's like those visualizers on your iTunes times 1,000.
Yeah.
It's perfect. It's not broken up. To me, in my opinion, something else is creating it. I don't know what it is, but there's something is creating that because there's no way I can create this amazing art and it's perfect and perfectly symmetric and it's like snakes of just crazy. So after like 5 minutes of just sitting there at the zoo, we thought we had like a fear and loathing in Las Vegas moment where we just had to get out. We ran to the parking lot and it's at the LA Zoo and we're looking at the mountains. I'm like, are you looking at the mountains? Look at the mountains. And I instantly understood what all the Aztec art was all about. I'm like, that's what they're seeing. I go, you look at the mountains were dancing.
Yeah.
And the guy who gave it to me goes, dude, the clouds are going to dance for you. I thought that was a metaphor. I didn't know he actually meant that. And anytime you focus on something for 1 second, you look at the clouds, they start dancing for you all perfectly. It's like,
well, it's a weird feeling because it feels like something's there all the time. You just can't see it. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Whenever I've been on mushrooms, like, when I was talking about the one where Doug and I took the Amanita muscaria and then the psilocybin,
yeah,
the feeling I got, and it didn't last very long because there was so many things going through our head, and it was the day of the Iraq war, the day the war started, so it was a pretty freaky moment. But I saw this honeycomb pattern in front of me, like where everything, I saw like the pattern of the universe, and it like occurred to me like, oh, this is here all the time. I just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it feels like when you see those things dancing.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was incredible. It was so hard. That was the craziest drive home. It was exact. When first time I saw Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I thought, man, this is so unrealistic. You don't see shit like that when you get high. I've been high plenty of times. You don't. But I understood it because the drive home, I didn't know. I should have been dead. There's no way I should have made it home. I didn't know if there was cars next to me that were right here. It felt like I was driving through a jungle. It was crazy.
Remember you called me, said, dude, the road turned into flower petals.
Yes, yes. Like I was being guided by, I was in a jungle and there was flowers and green moss and I'm driving through it and I could see the cars like in the distance, but just in my little cube, my little circle, I was in the forest.
Yeah, I can't believe you drove through that. That's when I should have
been dead. I don't recommend that. If you're going to experiment with psychedelics, stay home.
Yeah.
Stay home.
Stay where you're at.
Because the great part of it is being in a dark room and closing your eyes and checking out the light show in your head. It's not like you pass out or anything. Like if you smoke DMT, you pass out and it's kind of like you're in a dream state. But with mushrooms, you're completely conscious. You're talking, but as soon as you close your eyes, it isn't like it takes 10, 15, 20 seconds to dissolve into the show. The instant you close your eyes, it's right there waiting for you. It's like right in front of your eyes, and it's deep. It's like five-dimensional, and it's perfect. There's nothing breaking off. It's just It to me, there was some intelligence behind it.
Well, it certainly feels like there's some intelligence behind it. But the thing that's always struck me as weird is it always feels like it's there all the time.
Yeah.
Like whenever I do DMT, one of the weirdest things that happens is this feeling like, oh, I've been here before. Even before I ever did it. The first time I ever did it, I was like, I've been here before. I know this place. Like, I know this place, you know? It's, I don't know why.
I felt that with mushrooms also. Yeah. I felt all those, it seems like all those hallucinogens, like I said, I've done this before.
Well, one of the reasons most likely is that mushrooms and DMT, all these things like mimic human neurochemistry. So the real wonder is what's happening to you while you're sleeping? What's happening to you for that 6 to 8 hours, whatever it is, where you're out cold? They don't really know, but they do know that the human mind mimics the reactions to dimethyltryptamine. Not only does it produce dimethyltryptamine, but it produces similar reactions, like dreams. When you're done with a dream, it's hard to remember it. You know?
Yeah.
You know how that is?
Yeah.
You know, it's weird, man. It's like the dream is so amazing. I've said to myself, too, like, oh, I don't even have to write this down because I'm going to remember it because I'm a lazy bitch. I don't want to get up and write something down. I'm like, I'm not going to forget this. And then I wake up in the morning like, what the fuck was it? Yeah. I don't remember it at all.
You forget. Yeah.
DMT is the same way. You do DMT and the dream, just whatever it was, whatever the experience was, disappears. Like in the morning, you can't remember it. Or when it's over, rather. You can't remember it.
Well, how about when you're dreaming? You don't remember reality.
Exactly.
Right?
It's true.
You don't remember it so much that your uncle could be David Cassidy and you'd be like fine with it.
You know what I mean?
You're like, you're totally cool with it. You're not going, wait a minute, how the fuck is he my uncle? You're like, yeah, hey, he's my uncle.
The Partridge Family?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
I actually had a dream like that.
Did you really? David Cassidy?
Yeah, like random people would show up in my dream and you accept it. You remember this dimension as much as you remember your dream state when you're in this dimension. So it's like, man, what is it really? And when you think about like that we're all empty space, you know, that quantum theory where, you know, at the subatomic levels we're 99.9999% empty, like this is empty, your body's empty. Like, how is that possible? It's solid. How is it possible that this is empty when you look at it at the subatomic level? How is that possible? It's so hard to wrap your brain around it.
Well,
right?
we had that Amit Goswami guy.
Yeah, yeah, I heard that great podcast.
Yeah, but did you understand a word he was saying?
Some of it. some of it.
I faked it through some of it.
I wonder if it has, like, the reason this is solid, I wonder, you know, because electromagnetic energy is running through everything, right? So it seems like it must be powering everything. Like, where do we get our electricity? Like, we're plugged into the universe somehow. And according to science, we're just flooded with electromagnetic energy and it's just running through everything. So it seems like that's how we might be plugged in and that's what's giving us the power, because it's not our muscles that are doing anything. It's the electric pulses that are doing it. That's where you're getting your strength from. And that's what's running your heart. You know, your heart isn't just beating. It's connected to this ocean of electromagnetic energy that we're in. So if we're electromagnetic energy, magnets might have something to do with it. So I'm thinking, you know, when you try to put a magnet together, there's like nothing there, but it's solid. Like maybe the subatomic particles that were created, it's solid because it's really just a magnet in its own little unique form. Like it's really not there. It's not, but the way it's... The photons or whatever, I'm just making shit up, are put together. The way they're put together, it's a certain form of magnet. Like, this is this kind of magnet. It's the skin magnet, but it's really not there. Just like when you try to put two magnets.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Well, we're all empty space. I'm trying.
Why? I don't get the magnet thing.
Well, when you try to put two magnets together, you can't. Because
right.
It's like you don't see anything there, but you just can't. It's just something solid.
Well, you can
there.
If you flip it.
But you know what I'm saying? That there's nothing there, yet it's solid. Like, they're saying something's there.
But
so maybe since we're all running through electromagnetic energy, now this is just my crazy stone theory, maybe it has some... Because people are baffled. The top scientists don't even know what the fuck... Like, how is this empty space? How is this empty space when it's solid to us? Maybe it has something to do with, like, particles being magnetized.
Who knows? But you know, the point.
These are
is,
just theories.
The point
okay,
is,
this is not in a book anywhere.
The reality, the reality of quantum mechanics. This is what we absolutely know: is that particles can be in a state of superposition, which means they're moving and they're still at the same time. Yeah. They blink in and out of existence. We have no
millions
idea
of times per second.
Yeah. And particles from, you know, here, they could be on the other side of the planet, and they react instantaneously, yeah, faster than the speed of light.
They split
to each other.
They've done experiments where they'll split a photon, yeah, and whatever they separated by 14 miles or whatever. One experiment was 14 miles there in different labs, and whatever they did to this half of the photon, the other half reacted in the exact same way. So
with
that's
no
baffling.
Lag. Yeah. With no lag at yeah. all. They don't yeah. understand
yeah.
it.
Yeah, so
it's just that alone is like, that's science fiction.
Yeah, those are all the
clues.
They
can blink in and out of existence.
Yeah, like, shit, how does it work?
I think there's something way more to this world than we're ever going to be able to wrap our heads around with what our crude minds and bodies can perceive of the reality yeah. that we exist in. Yeah. I think we have this idea that the reality that we exist in, the measurable reality we exist in, is all there is.
Yeah.
But I think there's probably a whole soup of possibilities that we're swimming yeah. in.
We don't know
we're
shit.
We're not interacting with
we
it.
Don't
we
know
don't have
shit.
The yeah. But we also know it exists. Like, that's karma. You know, that's love. That's like the when that's momentum. And you start having good things go your way. Good things tend to stay going your way, and it all sorts of feed into other yeah. good things. Yeah. There seems to be like a way the universe would like you to react and behave.
Yeah.
And it rewards you with like a positive experience.
Yeah.
It rewards you with love. And if you pay attention to people that are living like a fucking disaster of a life, the universe is not rewarding them. At every yeah. turn, it's fucking yeah. them up. Their car is breaking down. They're getting yeah. arrested. Their girl hits them in the head with a fucking frying pan while they're sleeping. It's like a constant stream of shit keeps coming their way until eventually they either die or get locked up. And it's like the universe is setting that up as well.
Yeah.
It's like it's life rewarding is, or not rewarding the correct behavior or the incorrect behavior.
Life is so perfect and so beautiful and so just incredible. I mean, as humans, we have the intelligence to make satellites and rockets and airplanes, but we can't even make a flea. We can't make a flea. We have no idea how that shit works.
Yeah, make a flea that can fuck
yeah,
and make another flea,
try to
too.
Make, how come we can't make a tree?
Yeah.
We can't make a tree.
Not yet.
We think we got to figure it out. We think there is no higher intelligence out there, some kind of something.
Yeah.
Come on.
It might even just be law. You know, it might just be a law of the universe or, you know, instead of a law, like an equation, like, you know, positive and love and this and that, it moves towards this direction, negative and horrible and evil moves towards that direction. And it's almost like the two need each other to do battle back and forth and to empower the other.
Absolutely. You know, Esther Hicks says, you know, it makes sense. Like, we're here. Who knows if this is true? This is just something that someone said that it seems pretty awesome to me. That it seems that we're here, we're existing. We're supposed to feel the pain, because if we don't feel the pain, we're not going to appreciate the good stuff, and it's not going to feel as good. Like, she uses an example of your best meal is always eaten when you're your hungriest. And that totally makes sense. Like,
yeah.
if you're never hungry, you won't really give a fuck about food.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're born a billionaire, you don't care about money. You don't care about what it can buy, and so it's almost like we need the pain. It's almost like we're here for the pain.
Well, there's certainly like reward systems built in, and it seems like if you look at like all the animals on this planet, at least there's a struggle that's going on constantly. Nobody lives easy. Everybody's struggling. You're struggling to find food. You're struggling to keep off predators. You're struggling to keep your young alive. And it seems like it's set up that way. It seems like it could be way easier if there was like total harmony in the animal world. Well, isn't like life and success like what they're looking for? Wouldn't they all just be fucking and eating plants? Wouldn't that be like the best way to go about it? But no, it seems like the struggle's built into to the whole code of life.
Yeah.
And there's a battle to try to figure out how to do it right.
Well, we want the struggle in a lot of things. In movies, we don't want to go to a movie where there's no conflict or nothing
yeah.
bad happens. That would be the worst movie ever.
It would suck.
The greatest movies are the ones that take you down to the depths and you buy it. You suspend your disbelief and you're down there, and then you come up with it and the story's believable and you lose yourself in the movie. But without the conflict, the movie sucks.
Do you worry about that with your kid? Like, in a certain way, I do with my kids. It's like, I don't want my kids to experience a lot of adversity. Just, you want to protect your children.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that all the people that I know that experience adversity are the most interesting people. You know, all the people that we know Think about all the people that you know. Look, think of like Joey Diaz. He's one of the most interesting guys ever because his life was completely crazy. Like his life was full total chaos. Like the adversity you had to go through, the adversity I had to go through, the adversity Callan had to go through. Like all the people that we know that are interesting, they all had kind of a fucked up life.
Yeah.
What's that about? Do you think that you could get away with just exposing your kid to difficult things like jiu-jitsu? Like exposing them to martial arts and maybe they could develop their character that way without having to go through the horrible ups and downs of...
I don't know if jiu-jitsu promotes or guarantees a great sense of humor and the ability to make other people laugh. But the one thing in my experience that I know that jiu-jitsu does for children, absolutely. And it's has a lot to do with you, what you always talk about. When a kid... it doesn't have martial arts and jiu-jitsu specifically because of the tapping and getting tapped out, what that shows you that automatically in jiu-jitsu, you know where you stand. You know where you stand. You know that you're a blue belt. You're probably not going to beat purple belts that much. But when you do, you'll get your purple belt. And you're probably not going to beat brown belts and black belts that much in the beginning. But when you start doing it, then you get your brown belt and so on and your black belt. So when a kid comes into jiu-jitsu and 4 years old, 5 years old, he knows that he's rarely going to beat the 7 year olds. And when he's seven, he's rarely going to beat the 10 year olds. So that teaches, if they don't go through that, there is a possibility, not always, there's plenty of great kids that have never done jiu-jitsu. But what I've seen with jiu-jitsu kids, it almost guarantees that they won't be delusional and become a douchebag kid. Because if you're not checked that way with the tap, like reminding you that, this guy's 15 years old. You better respect that 15-year-old. And then what ends up happening is when you become 15, you know what it was like going through the early stages of jiu-jitsu. So I see kids that are 10 and 11 are great with the 5-year-olds and great with the 6-year-olds. It takes you out of that delusionary state and lets you know that you better respect your elders. And as you get older, you better respect the kids too because they're going to get older too. So what jiu-jitsu really does is it instills discipline in you like most people think martial arts does, like karate and taekwondo, and that definitely works too because it does promote discipline, but jiu-jitsu does it, I think, better because of the tapping. Most kids that I know that are good at jiu-jitsu, they have a tremendous relationship with their father. It brings them tighter. Traveling all over the world like I do to all these seminars, I don't know how many times I've met kids, these jiu-jitsu phenoms that are 8, 9 years old, and their dads bring them to jiu-jitsu, and they're best friends. Avery down he used to be in Springfield, now he's in Omaha. He's 16 now. Him and his dad are best friends, and when I run into them, I'm like, man, give me advice. You know, what else did you do? Because you see it over and over again. So for those of you with kids out there and maybe you're having trouble with the kids, try to talk them into jiu-jitsu. You know, it might be hard, but I think that if you're having trouble with your kids or you want to ensure a beautiful relationship, a tight relationship, a trusting relationship, you know, a relationship where your kid wants to hang out with his pop and you do jiu-jitsu too, you do it with your kid, that's just a little something that I've learned. That's a little insight. You can take that for what it is. I'm just trying.
No, it's good advice. Anything the kid can do that's difficult, it's good for their personality development. Yeah. One of the real problems with kids today is because everything's handed to you. You don't develop character because you don't ever face adversity. Your food comes from a supermarket. You can go to a store and get whatever you fuck you need. You know, it's not hard. It's easy to live life. And so when you're not tested, especially as a young person, like a lot of bullying comes from insecurity. And people say, like, what's the best way to stop bullying? I always say the best way to stop bullying is teach kids how to fight. If you had, like, mandatory jiu-jitsu classes, if you had mandatory martial arts classes in school, you would have a whole lot less bullying. Because, first of all, they wouldn't be inclined to do it. And second of all, it wouldn't work. Like, if a guy is talented and skilled and he's 155 pounds and there's an asshole that's 180 pounds that's fucking with him, he's not going to back down. They're going to figure out a way around it. The kid's going to be able to figure out a way. Like, listen, you know, if you want to fucking fight, you want to be an asshole and pick on me, I have to fucking defend myself, then I'll defend myself. But it's not like he's going to be terrified and not know what the fuck to do. It's going to be a completely different scenario. And I think that one of the reasons why people do it in the first place is they're trying to prove that they aren't scared themselves. The reason why people are bullies, where they have that instinct, is they're insecure. They're trying to be dominant without putting in the work. But if you put in the work, if you do jiu-jitsu, if you learn a martial art, you actually develop some proficiency, you don't have that need. You don't have that need to dominate people. You don't have to need. You get it all out. You get it all out in the gym.
All my bullies were in the wrestling team. So that kind of like
no,
makes
wrestling's
sense.
Different. It's wrestling's a sport, and probably they're just sick of you.
No, I mean, were your? I mean, did you have bullies growing up?
Not really. Oh. I mean, I was bullied before I started doing martial arts, but from like 14 on, not really.
Because I was like thinking about like all my bullies were all guys in sports, like football team, wrestling, mostly
football,
wrestling,
big time,
a lot
yeah.
of wrestlers.
Yeah, with bullies in what way? Like, how were you bullied?
You know, like just pushed around on the like the playground and stuff like that. And, like,
what year are you talking tripping. About? Like,
I'm how talking old about middle school, elementary to middle school.
They used to trip you?
Yeah, trip you, like when you're walking and stuff like that.
Wow, you got dicked with.
Yeah, I was fucked with a lot. But then, like in high school, it went away.
It's a douchebag move, man, to be a bully. It's one of the worst things a person can do.
Yeah.
It's a weird natural human weakness. It's a weakness instinct to like, shut the fuck up, bitch.
Yeah, my shit was mostly because my parents were divorced and I was poor, I think was the big why they picked on me.
So they pick on you because you were poor?
Yeah, because I lived in Worthington, which is a higher-end place in Columbus, but I was like living on that one part that was all apartments that shouldn't have been in there, you know, but somehow I was in Worthington. So right. They knew I was poor and my parents were divorced back then. Back then, divorce wasn't as crazy as it is now where... You know, if you're
yeah,
divorced.
It was unusual.
Yeah,
back
a little
then.
Bit more unusual. Yeah,
isn't that weird that like when we were younger, people didn't bother getting divorced, or they didn't happen nearly as much?
Oh, right. not in my neighborhood. Everybody got divorced. All my friends didn't have fathers. All of them except one, Honorio wow. Galvin. He's the only one out of maybe 15 friends that we had growing up. Every father left.
You Los grew Angeles? Up in a really poor neighborhood.
It was
though.
All Mexican. Huh?
You grew up.
Mexicans be leaving. They get drunk and go back to Mexico and say fuck that.
Yeah. Isn't that weird, man? People that don't take care of their kids. As a father now, doesn't that freak you out?
Yeah, man. That I can't imagine.
Freaks
it.
Me out.
My
man.
Father had 19 kids from 8 different chicks.
Oh, my God.
19.
Is he still alive?
I don't know.
What kind of crazy hell does that guy live in when he closes his eyes at night?
One of the last time I saw him, I was 27, and on my mom's side, my mom's mother and father, they stayed together to the very end. They were married 50 plus years and had 10 kids. And my dad told me, first he told me at 14, I saw him at 14, then I saw him at 27. At 14, he tries to shove advice down my throat and he said, make sure you marry, when you marry your wife, she's at least 15 years younger than you. He told me that, I remember that. And he also said, and my wife is 15 years younger than me. It wasn't strategic, but it just happened that way. And the other thing he told me at 14 was be nice to kids because they grow up really fast and they'll turn into adults. So he was trying to give me the right advice. And then at 27, I hadn't seen him in forever. I thought he was dead. He shows up one day and at my grandfather's house, he goes, do what you, he's older. He's like, do what your grandfather did. That's the way. Have kids every Christmas and Thanksgiving. He has all his family and all his grandkids. That's the way. If I had to do it over, I would do it that way. That's what he said. He was a wow. massive player, just banging everything and just getting everybody pregnant.
Yeah. Wow, that's so sad.
Yeah.
That's a sad life, man.
Yeah. And I asked him, I go, what made you want to come by this time? I was like, he hadn't been around, and I heard he showed up to my grandfather's house. He had been friends with my grandfather while he was messing with my mom, and him and my grandfather got along. And my aunt called and goes, your dad's, get over here now. Your dad's at your grandma's. And I'm in Hollywood. I drive down to Orange County. And the whole drive down, I'm not going to give him a hard time. I hadn't seen him in like 13 years. I'm not going to give him a hard time. I'm just going to start over. I get another chance with my father. It was a long drive. It was like an hour drive. And show up at my grandma's house, and I'm happy. Got a smile. I'm like, damn. I thought he was dead. I'd have dreams of him dying. And is this real? He's right here? Shit. Let's go out to eat. Like, we went to Black Angus in Tustin. My mom went. We're all sitting there. I'm like, fuck. We get a second chance. Meanwhile, I'm all happy to see my father, and I rarely, you know, my mom wants to see me more than I actually drive down and see her, but now I want to start another relationship with my father. So then I asked my father, And at this point, I didn't know about his 19 kids. At this point, I thought he had 5 kids from a... I knew he was married, had 5 kids, and he was seeing my mom and on the side. I knew that. My mom was a side girl. That's what I knew at this point. And I said, why did you come by this time? I'm curious. And I was expecting him to say, it's been so long, I wanted to see what happened, you know, what's become of you. And he said, oh, I was passing through Orange County, and I wanted to see if your grandfather was still cool with me. I didn't know if he was mad at me or anything.
Wow.
And I just kept a smile on, and right there, I looked at my mom, and I'm like, fuck this dude. Fuck this guy. I'm going to spend time with my mom. Fuck that dude. And I just kept a smile on, and right there I made the decision. I will never see this guy ever again, and I never did. But...
That's so
during that dinner, he did say, hey, two of his kids live in L.A., the ones from that family. He goes, they want to have dinner with you. They want to meet you. So I did end up meeting with them, never saw them again. They're the ones who told me. They sat me down at the old spaghetti factory in Hollywood when I was 27. And they go, do you have any idea how many kids your father has? I said, 5 plus me. They go, he has 19 kids.
Wow.
I said, how did that happen? He goes, he got... Not only did they know about it, he told his family about every kid and every girl he was seeing. He was trying to drive his wife insane to get a divorce. She wouldn't divorce him. She was hardcore Catholic, so she wouldn't divorce. He wanted a divorce. He wanted to marry my mom. That's what he says, but she wouldn't give him a divorce, so he would tell her. They knew all about me. He goes, he would come home and just say, oh, Maria's pregnant now. Oh, Maria had the baby. We named it Edgar.
He would come home to his wife and
to his wife and kids and say, oh, Maria had just got pregnant. We just had our kid. I'll be gone for the weekend. I'm going to spend time with my son. So I actually spent my dad had my mom in an apartment promising that he would leave his. My mom thought he was going to leave his wife for her. She was in love. And he never did, but he had her in an apartment in downtown L.A. And then after like 3 years, apparently I lived with him for 3 years, my mom just said enough's enough. She went back to Orange County, back to her parents' house, and that was the end of that.
It's a weird thing, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
The idea that someone could just do that. When you have kids now and you get on a plane, we were talking about, you leave your house knowing you're going away for the weekend, you miss them as soon as you get in your car.
Yeah, as soon as you start driving away, yeah.
That this guy could just abandon his kid and then see you and not even have like a connection with you. Be like, yeah. Oh, I just want to see if your grandfather was mad at me.
Yeah. And then when I talked to them, when they told me about the 19 kids, it started to make sense. I'm like, no wonder he didn't give a fuck about me. Now I understand. I got 19 kids.
Right.
How can he? He was never a dick to me. When he would see me once a year, he would cruise by.
Did he hug you?
Maybe a little, not. But I found out that he never said I love you. He never told any of his kids I love you. Never said I love you. So he had something really wrong with him. So then it all became clear. I'm like, oh, this guy has no love in him. That's why he just keeps having kids with whoever, and he doesn't really care. He was never a dick to me. He just didn't really like care that much about me.
It's kind of weird because that's sort of like, if you look at nature, if you look at the programming of the human animal, that's like the programming. The programming is to spread your seed as much as possible. The programming is to have as many babies as you can. The program is not for the male to take care of them, though. It's really strange. You know, the program is to keep going, to keep spreading that seed. And that's one of the reasons why they say that, like, the intensity of an attraction, like, it goes away within a few months of meeting someone. Like, the intensity when you first meet them, that intensity of attraction for a man goes away within the first 5 or 6 months. Because usually by then, the woman's already pregnant in nature.
Yeah.
You've been banging her, you know, every day for several months. Yeah. One of the days she's been ovulating, you shot one in there and ensured this intense bond, you know, initially to make sure that you continued having sex as much as possible to increase your odds of getting them pregnant. And then all of a sudden this weird thing kicks in where you want to go.
Sometimes that kicks in as soon as you nut. Post nut syndrome, baby.
Yeah, but it's a weird thing. That nature is literally set up that way. And so in order to conform to what society expects from a person, you have to fight against your genetics. You have to literally fight your instinct. Your instinct to fuck other girls, the instinct to shoot loads into them and get them pregnant. It's weird.
Do you remember that when we worked on the Man Show, that sketch I wrote for post-nut syndrome? It was a pill that you could take where you could have sex with a girl and not get post-nut syndrome if you take it 30 minutes before sex.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, obviously, it never got green lighted, but it just reminded me of a. It'd be that cool is, if that was a pill, right?
That is a real thing with men, though.
Post-op syndrome is serious.
It's the feeling that you have, like, right after you come, you're like, oh my God, I gotta get out of here.
I gotta get out of here.
And if you don't have that, that's when you know, like, hey, I think she's found somebody.
Yeah, she's cool.
I think I found a real relationship.
Yeah. If you feel like, hey, let's go get something to eat, or let's don't leave, you let's watch TV.
What are you saying?
You guys
what?
Are spooners?
What are you saying? What?
After I come, I just want to spoon and snuggle and then
with go. Every chick.
Yeah, and then wake up and do it again. In
he's
the morning.
Half retarded.
Wow,
it's different. You know those girls that if you have sex with and they're really dumb and you go, oh my God, why did I do this?
You just want to jump out a window.
He's as smart as them, so it's perfect.
I don't have that kind of.
They lock up. They mesh perfectly. They talk about shoes.
Yeah.
They sit there and they talk about who's fat.
Girls don't really get post-nut syndrome unless they're married or something. And, you know, then they feel guilty. Yeah. But if they're not married, if they have sex with you, they fall more in love with you.
Oh, that depends especially entirely. That depends entirely on what the experience was like.
Generally,
sure.
though, right? More really? The guys get post-nut syndrome way more than girls.
It's also the guys that we know, too. We know a bunch of savages. You know, yeah. If you compare, like, we went to an accountant's meeting, you know, and said, hey, how do you guys feel after you come? What? You know, some people, man, you start talking to them about sex. It's a weird thing when dudes start talking, like you and I have done this before. We won't name any names, but we've had sex conversations around square dudes and you watch them panic. Yeah. Like they absolutely panic, you know, like they don't know what the fuck to say. Like how often you fuck your wife? Be serious. And some guys will tell you like, I fuck my wife like 3 times a week. No more than that. Like I don't want to fuck her every day, but I fuck her a lot. And some guys will just go, what? They just
twice
clam up.
Twice
like,
a day.
I can't, or they will say, I can't. No, it's just not something that I discuss. Yeah. Like, you don't discuss how often you bang your wife with another man. Like, why wouldn't you discuss that?
Yeah.
Do you not love your wife? If you love your wife, you have sex with your wife. So is that off the books? You can't talk about it? Like, what do you, I'm not asking you like specific details.
You know what's crazy about my wife is before the kid, you know, once you're going out with a girl for a year or 2 years, you come home from jiu-jitsu, my classes are kind of late. A lot of times I'm broken. I just went to war for an hour with guys from out of town trying to tap me. I come home, I'm going to drink a protein shake. I'm going to get on the internet a little bit. I'm just going to collapse and die, generally, after jiu-jitsu. So, you know, for a while there, you know, it's like I have sex tomorrow. You just keep putting it off, and you don't have sex as much. And then when you have a kid, now you can only have sex when that baby's asleep, right? So now I really can't have it that much. So I want it way more than ever. Jesus
Christ.
Hey, don't
be easy with the voice in the microphone.
I want it way more than ever.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. I like it. People I like it. The one thing I learned in my old age, because I've dated girls that didn't, some girls didn't want sex as much as I did. And that would kind of piss me off. I'm 23, and it's like, man, this is bullshit. I should get it whenever I want. You're my girlfriend. Why are you? Oh, you're tired. Like I would get pissed off, and I'm like, man, I want a girl that wants to fuck anytime I want it. You know. So, but then you have girls, and I've had most girls were wanted it more than I did. I was always the tired one, and they always want it more. And I get to the point where it's kind of bothersome. I'm like, damn, she wants it way too much. But now, looking back at all that and where I'm at now, I would rather want it all the time and rarely get it than always get it and rarely want it. That's the one thing.
That's definitely better.
Yeah.
As long as you are still getting it.
Yes.
Yo, did you see this? They Chael Sonnen and Vanderlei Silva are going to host Tough Brazil. The Ultimate Fighter
That's
Brazil.
Perfect.
Chael Sonnen is going to go to fucking Brazil. Yeah. That crazy asshole. After all the shit that he talked on Brazilians and Vanderlei Silva. And Chael has been like putting like these rhymes up on his Twitter account.
Is it going to be in English or Brazil? I'm Brazilian.
Oh, it's going to be both. It's going to be Americans fighting against Brazilians. 16 Whoa. Americans will go to war to find 8 guys, and then 16 Brazilians will go to war to find 8 guys.
That might be the greatest
and
tough
then
ever.
Those two teams, they might have a lot of extracurricular violence.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be careful. If your coach is Chael Sonnen, and he said a lot of nasty shit.
Yeah.
Excuse me, a lot of nasty shit about Brazilians. But he's just talking trash. That's all he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, if you asked him honestly off the record, he'd say they're great fighters. It's an honor and all that jazz. But he talks so much mad shit.
Yeah.
And Vanderlei wants to kill him.
Yeah.
Vanderlei and him is going to be a crazy fight, man. That's going to be crazy. As long as Vanderlei's healthy.
I don't want to name any names or any seasons or anything, but apparently there's been some stuff on The Ultimate Fighter that happened behind the scenes that was so violent that they didn't even want to air it.
Really?
Have you heard about that?
Like fights?
Yeah. Like there have been fights that they just completely edit out.
Really?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it. Dudes get crazy.
Yeah, man.
Did they have them all still living in houses together? Like they...
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yep. This season, they have girls and guys living together. Oh, 8 girl fighters and 8... It's a great season. This year's season is awesome.
That house must smell so bad.
That's...
Protein farts.
They clean that
sweat,
shit. Yeah.
And dirty ass.
It definitely probably smells bad.
Are you watching the season?
Yeah, it's good.
Dude, I love
it. Dude, the drama between those two chicks, man.
Jasmine Duke and what was the girl she fought? Raquel Pennington or something? Was that her name?
I'm not sure.
But she can hit hard.
I don't know the girl's names. Yeah.
Yeah, but Jasmine Duke, man, talk about heart. She was getting hit hard, and she kept coming back, throwing knees, throwing down. And she's actually more of a jiu-jitsu chick than she is a striker. And, man, talk about heart. She's out in L.A. now training with Ronda Rousey's team.
Dude, you got to come to the one in December, the UFC in December, December 28th. Come to Vegas. You got to come.
Okay.
That's the one where Ronda's going to fight Miesha Tate.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. You got to be there. And it's also Chris Weidman, Anderson Silva, Dos.
Oh, damn, I'm there.
Yeah, you got to be there. That Miesha Tate fights Ronda Rousey, when they actually step into the octagon, oh my goodness. That's going to be that might be the most insane evening ever.
Is that Barnett also? Or is that the 18th or something like that?
Let's find out.
Who's Barnett fighting next?
He's fighting Travis Brown.
Oh, that's right.
Shit, son.
Good fight.
Fuck yeah, it is. Yeah. Let me see.
Those front snap kicks are coming back strong, aren't
they? Yeah,
they everyone's
are,
throwing those.
Yeah, it's crazy. Isn't it weird? That technique barely even existed.
Do you remember us going over it in your garage and putting it on Mastering the System?
Yeah.
And I remember asking about it. I go, why haven't we seen the front snap kick so much?
It's hard to land.
Yeah, and you were like, it's hard to generate power, and you were throwing a couple. I'm like, when you were throwing, I'm like, that looks like it would hurt if it landed. And boom, right after that, Anderson dropped Couture with it. Or no, Anderson dropped Vitor, right?
Vitor, yeah.
And then Machida dropped Couture. And now everyone's throwing those snap kicks.
Yeah.
Overeem goes down with them.
That's a big technique now.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Anderson's fight card. Anderson Silva, Weidman 2. Oh, my God. This is an amazing card.
Oh, shit.
Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate, Travis Brown, Josh Barnett.
Oh, shit.
Gleason Tibau versus Michael Johnson. Chris Lieben versus Uriah Hall. Oh, shit.
Wow. Wait. Chris Lieben?
Chris Lieben versus Uriah Hall.
How is that possible?
Oh, shit.
Chris Lieben is a 185.
They're fighting.
Oh, Uriah Hall. I thought I was thinking Uriah Faber.
Faber.
Okay,
no,
okay,
Uriah Hall, the winner of Ultimate Fighter.
Okay.
Dennis Seaver versus Manny Gambierian.
Ooh.
Oh, my goodness.
That's gonna
oh
be
my
good.
Goodness!
Josh Burnett's on it. Sweet.
Oh, C.R. Bahadazura. How do you say it? Bahadazada versus Doomsday Howard. Holy shit! Dustin Poirier versus Daniel Brandao.
Oh
my God! This card's insane.
Yeah.
That's December 28th.
Jim Miller versus Fabricio Camões.
Damn!
Oh my God! This card's insane.
I think Fabricio Camões is that guy that hit that badass triangle from the mount.
Maybe, but now, yeah.
Oh, no, that was Sergio something. It's a different guy, I'm sorry.
I don't know who did it.
Yeah, different guy.
Either way, what a fucking card. What a card. This weekend, I'm going to, I'm headed to England. I'm going to Manchester.
Sweet. UFC?
Yeah, well, I was going to do that blood treatment thing in Germany.
Uh-huh.
But now I'm going to do it in Santa Monica. They do it in Santa Monica.
What's the blood treatment?
So stem cell thing that guys do for their discs. It's supposed to be incredible. That's the one thing that kept me out of jiu-jitsu. I've been, like we were talking about, been injuries, and you look forward to getting back to jiu-jitsu. I've been stitched up before. I've had 2 knee surgeries, and I went back to jiu-jitsu. I had my nose fixed, went back to new jiu-jitsu, and everything's fine. But this was a scary one. when you start getting numb hands, and then we knew quite a few people that have had like real serious issues with their backs, where they have atrophy of their arms, and Boss Rutan has one arm that's like literally half the size of his other arm. It's scary. So I wasn't down with any surgeries, man. I wanted to make sure that I did all the right things as far as rehabilitate. And I got a lot stronger. I came back that one day and rolled pretty fucking hard and didn't have any problems, but it was real stiff. And the next day it was stiff and sore, but I'm like, at least I could roll. I know I can roll, but I think I can make this thing better.
You haven't rolled
before
since?
Before I go back. I haven't rolled since. Mostly been doing just Muay Thai and a lot of weightlifting, which doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me with kettlebells, and it doesn't bother me with Muay Thai. It's just getting my neck cranked. And the day I came back to the gym, too, it was all arm triangles. It was, arm triangle transitions and guillotines, which is my favorite. I love arm triangles, but goddamn, there's a lot of shit going on with your neck.
So how are you feeling right now today?
I feel fine. Stiff. My back's stiff. But that's just because I lifted weights yesterday pretty hard.
Man, I hope that works out for you.
Me too. You got to do it too, man.
Yeah,
you got to try that shit.
My back's feeling great, but I would...
It'd make it even
better. It's not 100%.
Right.
But it doesn't stop me from rolling, doesn't stop me from training. I just got to really focus on keeping my hamstrings nice and stretched. I never stretched my hamstrings ever. That's the downfall of lower backs tense and tight hamstrings. So that's a new thing of mine where every morning I'm waking up, I'm stretching my hamstrings before class, after class. Sometimes, you know, I don't have time, but I'm more committed to stretching my hamstrings more than anything, other stretch.
This is what this stuff is. That's important, but this is what this stuff it's called. It's the way the term is called regenokine, regenokine. Orthokine is the actual medical procedure, and they take your blood, extract it, they manipulate it somehow, then reintroduce it to the body as an anti-inflammatory drug to reduce chronic pain and arthritis. And the process involves 2 ounces of blood drawn from your arm, then it's incubated in a slightly raised temperature. The liquid is then placed in a centrifuge until its constituent parts are separated. The middle yellowish layer is dense with agents that are believed to stop an arthritic agent known as interleukin-1, which causes degeneration of the joints and a breakdown of cartilage. That serum is injected into the patient's affected area. The procedure reduces pain and discomfort to the joint, and the treatment generally lasts 5 days with 6 shots of the serum into the affected area. It's normal for a patient to receive annual injections to ease joint discomfort. So many pro athletes have done this and had miraculous recoveries. Peyton Manning went to Germany for this. He had 2 neck surgeries, and he was on his way out of football, and now he's a fucking superstar again.
He's having the best year of his life.
Yeah, it's from this shit. Dana White did it, and he's just raves about the results of it. It's supposed to be incredible.
If you have arthritis in your spine, your lower back, Lewis Ho from 10th Planet Montreal has got this. He's got arthritis in his back.
Yeah, I guarantee you this would help him. I mean, I don't know how much he has. I don't know what I haven't seen his MRI, but I guarantee you that this would make him feel better than he feels now. I'm going to I'll give everybody the breakdown of it when I do it. I start next week when I get back from England. I go in we'll see what happens.
MRI?
Yeah, I already had all that shit done. Yeah. I had my MRI done right after the injury. It looked pretty nasty, man. I had a 6 millimeter bulge in my neck. It's pretty big. You know, it's reduced now quite a bit, but right after the injury, it was 6 millimeters. That's not good, and that's why I was having numb hands and all that shit. And you know what it's from? It's from doing it, getting injured, and then taking a couple weeks off and jumping right back in. That's what it is, not allowing myself to fully heal up. And core strengthening. Core strengthening is massive. It's so important. You know, if you're going to be in there throwing down on a regular basis, you got to do some core workouts. You got to do something that keeps you, gives you a little armor to protect you from being injured.
Yeah. You know? Squats.
Squats help a lot. Squats, windmills, kettlebell windmills are huge. I love those. That is strengthening your entire core, you know, all that bending and carrying that heavy weight, Turkish get-ups, that kind of shit.
You're doing any shows when you're in England?
I am doing 2 shows, the Dance House Theater. They're both sold out, so go fuck yourselves, English people.
Are you bringing anyone?
Too late. No, I'm going with a guy who's there. Local kid. And Dave Bishop. Bishop's going to...
Oh, he's doing comedy again. He came
back. No, he's going to just introduce us.
Mark Hayden ever go over there? You ever see Mark Hayden?
Oh. Like Candyman. You just said him twice. Don't say the third time. He'll show up. That's it. This podcast is over. Thanks to LegalZoom.com.
Can I throw a couple seminars?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a second. Go to LegalZoom.com, enter in the code name Rogan in the referral box, save yourself some money. And Audible.com, go to Audible.com/Joe and save yourself some money by getting a free audiobook and 30 free days of Audible service. Over 150 different titles to choose from. You will fucking love them. Thanks also to onnit.com. Go to O-N-N-I-T. Use the code name Rogan and save 10% off any and all supplements. What's going on, Eddie Bravo?
I'm
going to
be at 10th Planet Yuma November 9th. I'm going to be at 10th Planet San Francisco, November 23rd. Go to 10thplanetjj.com. Get on the Nibiru Forum, my message board, for all the info and details. My podcast is Eddie Bravo Radio. It's on iTunes and Stitcher.
And, dude, send me your seminars when you're doing them. I tweet them for you. I tweet everybody's dates.
I never want to bother you with
that. Don't worry.
You've done so much for me, man.
It's not a bother. People love it. They want it. And anybody who's interested, you know, it's something to do. You should do it. You'll learn a lot. Seminars are awesome. It's a great way to see a new aspect of jiu-jitsu, to check out a different person's game. And I know how much time and effort you put into them. They're awesome. They're great seminars.
Well, thank you very much.
Shit, I've been going to your seminars since... Damn, when was the first one we did? God, it was a long-ass time ago.
The first one, I think...
Colorado? Boulder?
When we started doing seminars with your comedy kids?
Yeah.
We did one in Miami. Remember that?
Oh, yeah,
which
that's
was like
right.
An hour late.
Do you remember how crazy that rain was?
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
We hit a wall of water in Miami that you couldn't see anything in front of you.
You had to stop on the freeway.
The whole freeway stopped dead for rain.
Stop.
It was fucking crazy.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
I haven't did a seminar in Miami in forever. Jesus.
A lot of jiu-jitsu.
I think that was
Miami.
The last time. That was the last time.
There's a lot of jiu-jitsu in Miami.
ATT.
A lot of MMA in Miami. A lot of jiu-jitsu.
A lot of Brazilians like that Miami weather.
So follow him on Twitter. It's Eddie Bravo on Twitter or 10thplanetjj.com. And come down to headquarters. And as soon as I get this back shit settled out, within the next month or so, I'll be back on a regular basis.
I teach downtown. Just email me for info, twisterbravo@sbcglobal.net.
And we should, once I'm back in, man, we should do some shit together. We'll figure out do some seminars in the same place where I'm doing comedy. Let's work
insane.
That out. Let's do something.
That. I'm down.
Let's make it happen, bitch. Beautiful. All right, folks, we will be back soon next week. I got Sam Harris is here next week. Should be a lot of fun. And someone else as well. I forget who. Don't worry about it. It'll be good. Don't sweat it. All right? Keep it together, you dirty freaks. And I will be at the Irvine Improv November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's the next date coming out that's available. The River Cree in Edmonton, I think, is sold out. And then I'm in Vegas on December 28th at the Mirage. 27th or 28th? Which one is that? Which one's Friday? December 27th at the Mirage in Vegas with the one and only Joey motherfucking Coco Diaz. So holla at your boy. All right, we'll see you fucks very soon. We love the shit out of you. And thanks for all the love back. Mwah, big kiss. Thanks everybody came to Houston this weekend too.
Thank you.
Had a great fucking time.
Thank you for having me, man.